Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And so I say to young people, you young people, as you're preparing your life and your life's career, make sure that you choose well in your profession and see it, whatever it is, as a service to improve the human condition. I believe this is possible no matter what choice you make. Martin Luther King Jr. is remembered by one of his sermons, which was preached about 2 months before his assassination, called The Drum Major Instinct. He talked about how he wanted to be remembered. And very often, when I'm being interviewed, the interviewer will say, "How do you want to be remembered, Mrs. King?" And I found it difficult to say how I want to be remembered. But Barbara, as I get older, I guess I have to start thinking about it. You have to think about what your legacy is going to be. But Martin Luther King Jr. said, "I'd like to be remembered as one who tried to love and serve humanity." Don't talk about the fact that I have a PhD degree and all the other awards and honorary degrees that I have. Don't even talk about the fact that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That's not important. All I want you to say is that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love and serve humanity. I tried to be right on the war question. I tried to visit those who were in prison. I tried to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked. Those are the things that Martin Luther King Jr. wanted to be remembered by.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, April 7th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our second study session on the late Coretta Scott King. She passed away in 2006. That was a speech that she gave in Baltimore, Maryland in 1997. We are picking up her autobiography, co-authored by Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds. Her autobiography, we're picking up, we are in chapter 3. This is kind of the early stages of Mrs. King's courtship with the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I thought it was fitting, her commentary on Dr. King this week, the 49th year anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King in 69, and the 50th anniversary of his famous Riverside speech, where he spoke against the Vietnam conflict, in the 1960s publicly speaking against the Vietnam conflict, which was very unpopular at that time. And not a coincidence that exactly 1 year to the day from his Vietnam speech, he was assassinated. But I thought that was a fitting introduction to this week's segment. And without further ado, we will get started. This is the context of white supremacy. This is the second session. Coretta Scott King's My Life, My Love, My Legacy, audio segment, part one.
As our courtship continued, we talked at length about values, morals, and philosophy. And it was clear on all the important things that Martin and I basically agreed. The other issues we felt could be worked out. As we talked about marriage, Martin made it clear that a man should be able to take care of his wife and she should not work. This was the 50s, when it was the norm for men to stake their manhood on their ability to provide for their households. Men worked, wives stayed at home. But in my view, that was such a waste of a woman's creativity, talent, and energy. If a woman wanted to work, she should be able to do so, I countered. That said, it became clear that Martin wanted a stay-at-home wife who was intelligent and well-educated, but who would be a homemaker and a mother of his children. Martin explained that it was his quest to become pastor of a large black Baptist church in the South. He wanted to know if I could adjust to the rigors of the life of a pastor's wife. He wanted to know how well I could relate to women who were uneducated and unsophisticated. I reminded him that I had been born on a farm, and that the most important woman in my life was my mother, who had only a fourth-grade education. Nevertheless, she had enough common sense to run circles around some people I knew who had PhDs. That said, I understood Martin's concerns. I carried myself in the ladylike fashion that I had learned from my mother, who always behaved with great dignity. In the South, since black women were so disrespected by whites, our response was to push our shoulders back, keep our heads high, and walk with dignity, looking as if we had oil wells in our backyard. Moreover, I was not on a traditional career track for a black woman. As a budding concert singer, poise and decorum were tools of the art. Unfortunately, they could be mistaken for stiffness or for trying to be a prima donna. However, as someone from the rural South who grew up without many cultural advantages, I never had any problem identifying with my heritage. I knew that no matter how far I climbed, I could never forget my origins or look down on anybody. Though Martin continued to press the issue of marriage, I still resisted a relationship, harboring nagging concerns about what would happen to my own sense of mission if I married. At one point, my own desire to minister to the needs of the less fortunate prompted me to feel that I might be called by God to preach. In this situation, as usual, I relied on God, engaging in serious prayer and meditation to help me settle a matter I felt strongly about in my heart. I couldn't involve my whole heart until I got a strong signal from God. There was also the issue that Martin's dad, whom Martin loved and respected very much, wanted him to marry the girl back home, even as Martin told him, "I am going to select my own wife. I know the kind of wife I need." Then in early May, several months after Martin and I met, I had a dream that helped bring clarity. In the dream, Martin's father, whom I had never met, was smiling at me, and I had this overwhelming sense that he approved of me. When I woke up, I felt as if weights had dropped off my back. I felt this was a miraculous sign, urging me to open myself to a serious relationship with Martin. Finally, I realized I had begun to fall in love with him. Then came a letter from my sister Edith, where she wrote, "Coretta, don't be silly, girl. You know how difficult it is to find intelligent, stable, well-adjusted men. You won't have your career as you dreamed it, but you will have your career." Moreover, I had finally realized that I wanted to have love in my life as well as a family. I understood that having a career without a family and true love would not make me happy. There was also the advice I got from my good friend Francis Lucas, whom I had met at the Friendly Inn Settlement House in Cleveland as a second-year student on a cooperative work experience from Antioch College. Fran was a graduate student doing field work at Friendly Inn. Now a New Yorker, Fran knew Martin. She and Martin's sister, Christine, used to stay at the YWCA in New York City while they were doing graduate work. When I told Fran about Martin's proposal, she confirmed what I already felt. You two are ideally suited. Remember how you were so solid in your desire to be a catalyst for social change that you would talk to me way into the night until I fell asleep? You are both serious thinkers. Both of you are compassionate. She understood that I didn't want to marry someone so soon after meeting him. In those days, you didn't do that. But Fran encouraged me, saying, Martin would be fortunate to marry you because you're the kind of girl that would be more than a housewife to Martin. You could manage the house, the children, and his affairs. Your background and your experience in the North will give you a broader understanding of the circles Martin will have to travel in. All this feedback from people I loved and trusted further cemented my decision. But there was still another hurdle: meeting Martin's family. That June, I was going home to see my parents in Alabama. Martin asked if I would stop in Atlanta to meet his family. I had already met his sister, Christine. To test him, to see just how important it was that I meet his family, I told him that I didn't think I could come to Atlanta. He was very upset and snapped at me. If you don't want to come, just forget it. Forget the whole thing. I thought. A good sign. He really wants me to meet his parents. He really cares. The train that went from Boston to Alabama went through Atlanta. A stopover would not be out of my way. Besides, if I were considering marrying Martin, I needed to know as much as possible about his church and family, so I consented. During my first meeting with his family, they treated me cordially. Martin and his mother met me at the train station. Alberta, whom everyone affectionately called Mama King, was a short, stocky, fashionably dressed woman. She took my hand, greeted me politely. We went to Martin's family home, a lovely yellow brick house on one of Black Atlanta's most fashionable streets. Mary Powell, the classmate who had played matchmaker between me and Martin, was home for summer vacation, and I spent the night at her house. The next day, we joined the King family at Ebenezer Baptist Church, where three generations of Kings had pastored. Reverend King Sr., Martin's grandfather, Daddy King, Martin's father, and Martin himself, who had already taken over some responsibilities as an associate pastor. There was also A.D., Martin's brother, a minister. Sitting next to him was his pretty wife, Naomi, who was also from Alabama. The church, which seated 750, was a handsome building on Auburn Avenue, a major artery in the cultural, economic, and political life of Black Atlantans. The unpretentious interior was finished in off-white with polished gold-tone woodwork. There were lovely stained-glass windows. Behind the pulpit, the white-robed choir sat on tiers of seats. So this is the King family, I thought as I leaned into the pew. I had done my homework on the Kings, and over the years I would continue filling in the missing pieces. Daddy King was the second of 10 children, born to sharecroppers James and Delia King in 1899 on a plantation called Stockbridge, a few miles outside Atlanta. At first I thought that since Martin hailed from a great line of preachers, someone in the family must have had the forethought to name him after the great German theologian Martin Luther. But that was not the case. As a boy, Martin Sr. was actually called Mike because of his mother's insistence that she had named him after Michael, the archangel. With the same intensity, his father, James, insisted that he be named Martin Luther after two of his brothers. Since it was uncommon for blacks to have birth certificates, which could have settled the issue, as a compromise, he was always called Mike. At the request of his dying father, Mike took out the necessary legal papers to have his name changed, as well as the name of his firstborn, Martin Luther King Jr., who was also called Mike. From then on, he was officially Martin Luther King Sr., or within the family, Daddy King. Growing up, Daddy King spent a lot of time plowing behind a mule, so much so that school chums teased him about smelling like one. "I may smell like a mule, but I don't think like one," he retorted. That smell that seemed to follow him, however, made him very shy around the ladies. Daddy King had a miserable childhood because of the family's extreme poverty and because his father often drowned his troubles in alcohol. Daddy King saw his father get cheated out of his meager earnings at the plantation store, saw whites beat black people unmercifully, and even hang one man from a tree. When Daddy King was a child, a white man stripped him naked and beat him for not giving him a pail of water Daddy King was carrying home to his mother. When his mother Delia heard about the incident, she made him promise not to tell his father, fearing he would kill the white man and bring retribution down on the entire community. But far from letting the matter drop, she picked up a club, found the man, and beat him herself. In time, the story did get around, and James King went after the white man with a gun. The Kings had to go into hiding until the controversy blew over. James King used to regularly beat Mike's mother, especially after Saturday night binges. After one such episode, Daddy King became so furious he wrestled his father to the floor. Although James King apologized to his son the next day, Daddy King had had enough. At 14, he took off for Atlanta with nothing but the clothes on his back, his only pair of shoes slung over his shoulder. In Atlanta, he worked odd jobs, from mechanic to railroad fireman, before returning home for a few years. At 18, he left home for Atlanta again. This time, he worked in a tire plant and loading bales of cotton and driving a truck. He felt a strong pull to the ministry. Answering the call, he became pastor of two small churches and attended high school at night to earn his diploma. Eventually, he graduated from Morehouse College with a bachelor's degree in theology. He also met and married Alberta, the daughter of the Reverend Adam Daniel Williams and Jenny Celeste Parks Williams. Reverend Adam Daniel Williams, born just before the Emancipation Proclamation was signed in 1863, had literally come up from slavery. Williams took over Ebenezer in 1894, building it into one of the biggest, most prestigious black churches in the city. A strong civil rights leader, Williams helped force Atlanta to build Booker T. Washington High School, the city's first high school for blacks. In 1927, Daddy King became assistant pastor of his father-in-law's church. In the spring of 1931, Dr. Williams died suddenly on his 37th pastoral anniversary. In the fall, the congregation called Reverend King to pastor the church. Like Williams, Daddy King had become a civil rights leader and was active in the NAACP. He also became a founding director of the Negro Bank Citizens Trust and amassed interests in other businesses, carving out for himself a respectable place in Atlanta's black middle-class society. As I sat in church that June day, I fretted as my mind took off, rehearsing my fears. Despite my dream, Daddy King might not like me. Could Daddy King change Martin's mind? I thought. What if my parents didn't like Martin? How would I react to that? What if I didn't feel comfortable with their church? These questions weighed heavily on my mind. Overall, it was a pleasant and welcoming visit, but as I left to go spend the summer with my own family, I still didn't know exactly where I stood or if Martin and I had his family's full blessing. That fall, Martin and I returned to Boston to continue school. Our courtship and love for each other had grown stronger. Martin and his friend Philip Leonard had conveniently found an apartment near the conservatory. One day, Edith, who had come to visit me, and I stopped over at their flat, and Martin asked if I could cook. Actually, I could burn, as they say. From age 14, I had learned to take over a kitchen and turn out fried chicken, collard greens, and sweet potato pies, all the down-home fare that Southerners are noted for. So I set out to show Martin my stuff, cooking my specialty, banana pudding, and Martin's favorite cabbage dish, smothered in bacon. My sister prepared Creole-style pork chops, and we added cornbread. After Martin and Philip dined sufficiently, Martin said teasingly, "Well, you've passed the test." Though I did not like his choice of words, I was pleased that he appreciated my culinary skills. Finally, in November, the moment of truth arrived. Martin's father and mother came to visit him in Boston. They could see how serious Martin was about me. He was not seeing any other girls, and he had asked me to come by every day while his parents were in town. Martin wanted his parents to see that I was the only girl around him. But Daddy King had other ideas. One afternoon at Martin's apartment, things came to a head. Daddy King began talking about the Atlanta girls. "I don't understand my son. He's gone out with some of the finest, most beautiful, intelligent girls from fine families. Those girls have so much to offer." I tried to hold my peace, but feeling my temperature rising, I shot back, "I have something to offer, too." Daddy King didn't seem to hear me. He continued talking about the other girls Martin had dated. Martin's stillness and lack of response to his father irked me as much as Daddy King's overlooking my fine qualities, which certainly matched those of the women he was praising so highly. Martin sat, not saying a word, grinning like an embarrassed schoolboy. He did not want to challenge his father any more than he had already done. I waited, wondering why Martin wasn't saying anything, why he wasn't defending me. Without saying anything to his father, Martin rose, went into the room where his mother was, and said, "Coretta is going to be my wife." As Martin drove me home that night, he seemed disappointed that I hadn't made a better impression on his father. I expressed my angst that his father had disregarded my feelings by talking about those other girls in Atlanta. 2 days later, however, I learned that I had made a better impression than I thought. During dinner, Daddy King slammed his hand down on the table and said, "You two are courting real hard. It is best that you get married." Only later did I find out what a sense of humor Daddy King had. Each time I would perform at a concert or excel in some way, he would remind me of what I had told him. He would say, "Coretta, I have something to offer too." These lines would produce much riotous laughter. By then, I too could join in the fun. Later, I would learn how Martin's sister Christine had beat the drum for me, and how Daddy King was impressed that his little granddaughter Alvita was so fond of me. She had nicknamed me Coco. When Martin went home for Christmas, he discussed with his parents our plans to marry. They suggested we announce our engagement around Easter in the only black newspaper in Atlanta, the Atlanta Daily World. We would be married in June, after the school year ended. As I hashed and rehashed my decision, I thought about what Edith, who was very fond of Martin, had said. "You won't have your career as you dreamed it, but you will have your career." With that in mind, I decided to switch my major at the conservatory from performing arts to music education, with a voice major and a minor in violin. This way, wherever Martin and I lived, I could supplement our income by teaching. 1 year and 4 months after we met, on June 18, 1953, Daddy King married Martin and me on the lawn of my parents' home in Marion, the one that they had built to replace the house that was burned to the ground. A.D. was best man, and Edith was maid of honor. A.D.'s daughter Alvita was the flower girl. I decided to forego a white formal gown and instead wore a pastel blue waltz-length dress. Although the wedding was small by Atlanta standards, it was one of the biggest weddings ever held in my hometown. All of the King family came from Atlanta, along with some of the deacons and trustees of Ebenezer Church. None of the Kings, not even Martin, had ever met my parents, and I was concerned about whether they would form a favorable impression of our home in the country. My knowledge of Martin and his family should have allayed such feelings, But I suppose all brides have apprehensions. I didn't want to look like I was trying to impress the Kings. At the same time, I wanted all of us to be hospitable and get along. I shouldn't have worried. As soon as Martin walked in the door, smiling, said hello, and kissed my mother, the ice was broken. I had made up my mind that I wanted the traditional language about obeying and submitting to my husband deleted from our marriage vows. The language made me feel too much like an indentured servant. I was worried that this break with tradition, which I later learned was quite revolutionary in the 50s, would anger either Daddy King, Martin, or both. To my surprise, neither one objected. Daddy King didn't object because he understood that the times were changing and young people were thinking differently. Martin didn't object because his view of women was more progressive than that of most men of his generation. Because there were no hotels that accommodated blacks in the South, we spent our wedding night in the home of a friend, who happened to be an undertaker. Throughout our marriage, Martin would sometimes jokingly reminisce about this. "Honey, do you remember we spent our honeymoon at a funeral parlor?" 4. A Brave Soldier. As much as one can feel relaxed in the aftermath of hateful, threatening phone calls, on the evening of January 30th, 1956, in the little house where we lived in Montgomery, Alabama, I was in a happy mood. It was about 9:30 at night, and I was comfortable in my bathrobe, chatting with my church friend Mary Lucy Williams in the front room. My infant daughter, Yolanda, we call her Yoki, was asleep in her crib in the back room. Suddenly, coming from the front porch, I heard a sound, a heavy thump and a rolling noise. I yelled to Mary, "Something's hit the house! Run to the back!" Before we could get halfway through the next room, a bomb exploded on the porch. The thunderous blast shattered the door and the window glass, leaving behind a cloud of putrid white smoke. It was the loudest explosion I had ever heard. The noise frightened my baby, who awoke crying. I ran and gathered her in my arms. I gasped, calling out, "Oh, my Lord," as I saw the damage the bomb had unleashed. Broken glass and pieces of wood were piled across the floors. We choked on the smoke that clogged the air. As we crept toward the front of the house to see if anyone was outside, we saw a big hole in the front wall and the porch hanging half off. The chair and sofa where Mary and I had been sitting was torn to pieces. Even the pictures on the walls had been shaken loose. I heard the doorbell ring, and for a moment I panicked. Were the perpetrators returning to kill us? I worried about what to do with my baby. How could I protect her? A concerned voice came through the front door. "Is anybody hurt?" I went to the door and let in my neighbors. They were astonished and angered by the devastating sight of the broken windows, the hole in the concrete floor, and the split porch. I picked up the phone to call the police, but quickly put the receiver back down. From my childhood in Marion, I knew better. Instead, I thanked God that we were yet alive. If we had remained at the front of the house when we heard the noise, we might have died. A few feet had spared our lives. Since the Montgomery bus boycott had begun 1 month before, we had experienced a barrage of harassing phone calls, including one particularly frightening caller who told Martin that if he didn't leave town in 3 days, they were going to bomb the house and kill our baby and me. Even so, I convinced myself that the call was an empty threat. When people call you up and tell you they're going to do something, they're probably not going to do it, I reasoned. They are just trying to scare you. But tonight I realized just how deadly real those threats could be. Long minutes passed before I could calm my nerves enough to call First Baptist Church, where Ralph Abernathy pastored and where Martin, who had recently been appointed leader of the movement, was speaking at a mass meeting about the boycott. I let them know that our house had been bombed and asked them to find Martin. I hung up, reminding myself of the need to stay calm, even as it was clear that anger and violence against those boycotting the city buses was escalating. Ever since hundreds of black maids, butlers, teachers, and preachers refused to board the buses that denigrated us as less than human, as the whites saw that we could not be intimidated, scared off, or bought off, the level of hostility had intensified. Young white ruffians would drive through black neighborhoods squirting urine on the faces, hair, suits, and dresses of any black person they could find. Adults and children would sometimes have to double back home to clean off the filth before they could proceed to school or work. The urine tossed from cars was humiliating, but that was the tip of the iceberg in terms of the violent intimidation. Crosses were being burned around town. Bricks were being thrown from windows, resulting in sprains and concussions. One well-known amateur boxer was stomped by a carload of white men who accosted him as he walked along the street. While I had dismissed the angry phone calls that came to our home night and day, Martin had calculated the possible outcome more clearly and insisted that a church member sit with Yoki and me whenever he was out. I was thankful that Mary was with me when the bomb hit our house. Seeing the glass and feeling the explosion was my wake-up call. I was shocked into a new reality. The perpetrators would do anything, even commit murder, to stop us. It sank in again. If there had been more dynamite or we had been closer to the explosion, Mary, my daughter, and I would have been killed. I had to be realistic, to stop and think about my own life and the life of my child. Soon, Martin rushed home from his meeting. By that time, an angry crowd had gathered outside. It was growing by the moment, and our house was so full of people that Martin had trouble getting in. The mayor and the police commissioner had also arrived. The police nervously held the crowd back. Martin had been assured that Yoki and I were all right, but he was surprised to find me so calm. Gently, he told me, "Why don't you get dressed, darling?" I was still wearing my house robe, and he wanted me to join him on the porch to hear him address the crowd outside. I lagged behind a moment to answer the phone. I wished I hadn't. It was a raging female voice. "I'm sorry we didn't kill all you bastards." Martin had a textbook understanding of the Christian Gandhian principles of nonviolence. We often debated the difference between pacifism and creative nonviolence. But that night, as I joined him on the porch in the heat of the crisis with pain and anguish all around, I saw that he was no longer the student. He was the practitioner, making the theories come alive as he spoke. This was his first test. His home had just been bombed. His wife and child could have been killed, yet he told the crowd very calmly that we were all right, and he asked them to go home. He had been told that a few of the men gathered there were armed with everything from broken bottles to pistols. "I want you to go home and put down your weapons," he said. "We cannot solve this problem with retaliatory violence. Remember the words of Jesus. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. We must love our white brothers no matter what they do to us." Going further still, he said, "This movement will not stop because God is with this movement. Go home with that glowing faith and radiant assurance." The atmosphere was so rife with tension that if a black man had tripped over a white man, it could have set off a riot. And if there had been a riot, Montgomery and the boycott would have turned into a dim memory, most likely recorded as the actions of out-of-control blacks with no mention of what had contributed to the violence. As soon as our parents heard about the bombing, they sprang into action. Early the next day, my father and Daddy King made the drive from their respective homes to Montgomery. They were on a mission with one thing on their minds: to save our lives, to take us home. After the bombing, Martin, Yoki, and I went to stay with Mr. and Mrs. Joseph T. Brooks, both of whom were well-respected musicians in church circles. Martin's sister, Christine, and his brother, A.D., drove up to their house along with our fathers. My father made me very nervous, pacing the floor as he tried to convince us to abandon Montgomery. And Daddy King's booming voice seemed to explode as he laid out the potential danger ahead. "Come on back to Atlanta. I need you at Ebenezer. It is better to be a live hero than a dead dog." Martin shook his head and stood his ground, looking like a little kid before his father. I think you need to step back and let someone else lead for a while because they are after you, my father told Martin. I will take Coretta and the baby home for a while until things cool off. It took a lot for me to stand my ground as well. I will not be returning home, I said. I would not be happy if I left. I am going to stay here with Martin. As I heard the flow of words streaming from my mouth, I felt as if I had an ear to my soul. The more I spoke, the stronger I felt. I had watched my father confront terrorism as a child. I was not new to the forces of hate and evil, but I had never been in a situation in which I had to make a personal commitment to put my body on the line, to know my life could be taken from me. I had never faced my own test of endurance. At the age of 28, I had no idea what I would do, given a choice like this. To face and endure some of the worst acts of physical hatred, or to run away. But in that moment, I summoned a resolve. I knew what I needed to do. What my heart called me to do. Stay. Daddy King did not give up easily. He walked the floor and preached to us through the night and until daybreak. By morning, we were all exhausted, but Martin and I dug in our heels and refused to leave. The next morning, after we had finished breakfast and our parents had left, Martin told me, Corey, you are a brave soldier. I don't know what I would do without you. Hearing those words from him kept me motivated to be the best friend and wife I could ever conceive of being to Martin. He needed me. In fact, I truly believe that if I had packed up and left Montgomery that night, Martin would have left with me. And if that had happened, one can only wonder, would Montgomery have birthed a movement that would electrify the world? Later, Martin would write of me, a wife can either make or break a husband. My wife was always stronger than I was through the struggle. In the darkest moments, she always brought the light of hope. I am convinced if I had not had a wife with the fortitude, strength, and calmness of Corey, I could not have withstood the ordeals and tensions surrounding the movement. The night of the bombing, I began to understand how much it meant to Martin to have a wife who was strong. And that's really when I made my commitment to go all the way. I remember it clearly. I remember how I felt. Inside my chest, I had this nervousness. Strangely enough, though, while I was nervous and torn between decisions, I was not afraid. There is a difference. I had known fear. I don't think any black person growing up in the Deep South escaped the reality that a black person's life could be taken by whites without any consequences. Yet that night, fear mixed with the faith I had known from childhood. In Montgomery, when tragedy hit, when I was tested, I found that the fear had left. It had been overcome by faith. I thought of Yoki, my baby. Love keeps you moving forward. I had no fear in Montgomery, not only because of the spiritual strength I had found there, but because of the unity and solidarity of the people. The Bible says that perfect love casts out all fear. I began to see love in action, how brave, how courageous black people were, how in the midst of such terror they could stand up and demand a better future for themselves, for their children. While our parents were worrying themselves to death about us, Martin and I felt secure. After the bombing, I also came to the conclusion that I was stronger in a crisis. I didn't panic or fall apart. I might get upset if the house is junky, but when there is a crisis, some mechanism inside me is set off. My mind kicks into high speed and starts racing towards solutions. Panic comes when you don't see a way out. I was learning that even in the midst of terror, there is always a way out. I had been taught and have come to believe in the words of the gospel song, God will make a way out of no way. As newlyweds in Boston, Martin and I had been like two school kids, playful and in love. We would go to Revere Beach Amusement Park, where Martin enjoyed the hair-raising roller coaster. He roller skated with his friend Philip Leenud, the two laughing and roughhousing until they were ready to drop. Once, when my rather serious mother was visiting and went with us to the park, she joked, "Martin, you know, you act like you are about 4 years old." Most portraits of Martin depict him as so intense, serene, and cerebral. You would not think, reading them, that he did everyday, normal things. But Martin was a prankster, a person who could bring fun into our lives and see the humor in the worst situations. Also, in Boston, and until events in Montgomery swept us up in their wake, Martin was quite the house husband. He was so secure about his manhood that he didn't equate helping me with housework as detracting from his masculinity. While he was researching his dissertation and I was finishing up at the conservatory, he was wonderful about helping with chores, and he didn't mind wearing an apron, often telling himself that it made him look manly. Martin did all the heavy cleaning, even the laundry. He would cook one night a week, usually Thursdays, and was proud of his culinary skills. Depending on how he felt, he would cook smothered cabbage and fried chicken. He could also cook turnip greens with ham hocks and cornbread. 6 months into our marriage, however, in January 1954, Martin accepted an invitation to preach at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, which was looking for someone to replace Dr. Vernon Johns, a fiery and fearless minister who was retiring. Martin's sermon topic was The Three Dimensions of a Complete Life. He made such a tremendous impression that a month later, he was invited to assume the pastorate. Having completed most of his work for his PhD in systematic theology from Boston University, Martin had any number of churches interested in offering him pastorates, particularly in Massachusetts and New York. But he felt his calling was in the South, which brought him closer to his family in Atlanta. I was not thrilled about leaving Boston and heading south. I would have preferred to move someplace at least more progressive, like Atlanta. After all, Montgomery was only 80 miles from Heiberger, the town where I grew up, and I thought I knew all too well what to expect from the city, once the capital of the Confederacy and one of the most racist places in America. Selfishly, perhaps, I wanted to participate for a while longer in the richer cultural life open to blacks in the North, where there was a wealth of opportunities for me to further my musical career. I was also concerned about raising children under the bonds of segregation. And having lived for so long in Antioch's Yellow Springs, Ohio, and in Boston, I knew what it was to ride anywhere you wanted on the subways and buses, to have quality friendships with whites, and not to have to move off the sidewalk when they walked by. If we returned, I feared that my will would be compressed and subjugated, that a body that knew what it meant to be free would be confined. The more we talked, the more I heard the shackles forming around my legs. But in the end, our going south was never an issue. I had wanted to go later rather than sooner, but during our courtship, Martin had prepared me in advance and let me know his intentions. So regardless of my private concerns, on September 1st, 1954, we officially moved into the parsonage at Dexter Baptist Church, where Martin began his first assignment as a full-time pastor, and I pressed on, ready to assume my role as a first lady and pastor's wife. When we moved, I told Martin, "I will make myself happy in Montgomery. You perfect your preaching and improve yourself in the ministry, and I will learn to be a good minister's wife." Which I did. I taught Sunday school and sang in the choir, using my formal musical training to make it one of the finest choirs in Montgomery. I also had the opportunity to appear in concert in several churches and at gatherings in surrounding towns, such as Shiloh Baptist Church in Brunswick, Georgia. Meanwhile, Martin divided his efforts between completing his dissertation and performing his church duties, rising daily at 5:30 to write and returning to it late at night. The remainder of the day was given over to church work, visiting the sick, officiating at marriages and funerals, and of course, preparing the Sunday sermon. Despite my intentions to carve out a low-key role as a pastor's wife, my role quickly evolved into more of a collaborative partnership with Martin. I began typing, listening, critiquing, and helping him prepare his sermons, something I continued to do throughout our married life. He would start his preparation around Monday. By Saturday, he would have the sermon written out word for word, and he would memorize it. He had a photographic memory, so he would go to the pulpit on Sunday and preach without notes. But in preparing the sermons, he would sometimes give me the subject matter and say, "Now, what would you call my first point?" Of course, I would think of something. Sometimes he would incorporate my suggestion into his sermon. Then he would rephrase it and go on to the next 2 points. Most of his sermons were 3-point sermons. I felt very much involved in what he was doing. As I worked with Martin's sermons and watched him preach, I grew to understand that he had the hand of God upon him. Before he mounted the sacred desk, the pulpit, he stood in the presence of God. Martin's sermons did much more than present a catchy title, a nice theme, or a message perfect in syntax and elocution. He spoke prophetically, bringing into existence images and a destiny we had not seen or lived before. It was his calling to help usher in the age of a new Negro, someone with starch in his or her backbone, someone with concern for others regardless of the obstacles. Unlike sermons by the preachers I heard growing up, Martin's sermons were not escapist. They did not call upon the listeners to look for salvation of their souls while their minds and bodies experienced the agony of disrespect and the terror of trying to live as less than what the Bible says they were, persons made in the image of God. One of his sermons, Loving Your Enemies, was built on many private discussions we had about Gandhian nonviolence and the power of Jesus' love to change minds, hearts, and behavior. Martin had to teach this concept, pound away at it continually and consistently, because nonviolence had to become a habit, a way of life for a people who would be commissioned to stand unarmed before terrorists with guns and bombs. As I listened to Martin, I had to gird myself with the sense of his reasoning. In the beginning, I don't think I was as committed to nonviolence as he was. I was committed to pacifism, which means not cooperating with evil. But I was not ready to confront violence head-on with nonviolence, as Martin conceptualized. I had to grow into that. I don't believe any of us is born with an innate ability to effectively respond to violent situations nonviolently. Too often we respond by doing nothing at all and resign ourselves to live with oppression, which is wrong because, as Martin said, non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as cooperation with good. Or we meet violence with violence, creating more social problems and leaving a bitter legacy for the next generations. Martin's ideology demanded that we confront violence in faith and love, which sometimes means moving directly into the line of fire. That is a call to pick up the cross of Jesus, to follow him and be prepared to die. In Martin's sermons, I saw how he prepared the congregation for a time when they would have to act upon the words he was instilling in their souls. In one sermon, he preached that the way to be integrated with yourself is to be sure that you meet every situation of life with an abounding love. Never hate, because it ends up in tragic, neurotic responses. There is a final reason I think that Jesus says, love your enemies. It is this, that love has within it a redemptive power, and there is a power there that eventually transforms individuals. That's why Jesus says, love your enemies, because if you hate your enemies, you have no way to redeem and to transform them. Even though they're mistreating you, keep on loving them. Just keep loving them, and they can't stand it too long. Oh, they react in many ways in the beginning. They react with guilt feelings, and sometimes they'll hate you a little more at the transition period, but just keep loving them. and by the power of love they will break down under the load. That's love, you see. It is redemptive, and this is why Jesus says love. There is something about love that builds you up and is creative. There is something about hate that tears down and is destructive. So love your enemies. It was incredibly affirming to see Martin excelling in his role as pastor. In addition to this, and to being welcomed into a vibrant church community, our move to Montgomery was made more enjoyable because of the friendship we formed with Ralph Abernathy and his wife Juanita. Ralph had come to hear Martin preach at Ebenezer in Atlanta when he, Ralph, was a graduate student at Atlanta University. When Martin was considering coming to Dexter, he called Ralph, a passionate preacher on social justice, who at the time had moved on to pastor First Baptist Church in Montgomery. Once we moved to Montgomery, the Abernathys invited us to dinner. A friendship took off from there. That spring, as we continued to settle into our lives in Montgomery, two wonderful things happened. After years of intensive study, Martin was awarded his PhD in systematic theology from Boston University, and I discovered I was pregnant. It seemed our lives were becoming complete. We both had our degrees, and we were starting a family. Martin had always said he wanted 8 children. After thinking it over, I offered a compromise of 4. We were on our way. During my pregnancy, Martin was particularly attentive. As many first-time parents do, we worried that something could go wrong. But on November 17, 1955, our little girl, Yolanda Yoki Denise, was born. She was a big, healthy baby weighing 9 pounds, 11½ ounces. Martin had wanted a son, but he was just as elated to have a daughter. She was born in St. Jude's Hospital, a Catholic institution that was the only hospital in Montgomery where blacks were treated with a modicum of respect. St. Jude's kept blacks and whites segregated unless the hospital became overcrowded. Then the racial ban was disregarded, and babies could take their first breath as equals, at least for a moment. In the segregated South, there was something about giving birth, especially for the first time, that tore at your heart, forcing you to confront painful realities. You want to protect your children, to keep them from having to experience the same hardships you've suffered. Somehow you want the muck and mire cleaned up so they won't be forced to slush through it. As I held my baby Yoki, so tiny and vulnerable, so beautiful, I reflected on some of my yesterdays and wondered aloud if those same harsh realities awaited her. One day when she was walking to school in her nice, clean dress with matching ribbons, would yellow school buses filled with jeering white children maliciously splash mud on her little dress as they had done to mine? In their ignorance, would the whites hurl vile names at her? My little girl! How could I protect her from the evils of inhumanity? My private thoughts about the birth of my firstborn were a soliloquy, spoken to no one but God. Yet it appeared that God must have been listening. In less than 2 weeks, a seamstress and NAACP secretary named Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus, and we began a movement that would become our life's work. Soon, answers would come to the very questions pouring out of my soul, and not only answers. God appeared to have appointed Martin and me, and those who would answer the call, to become the messengers.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade. And for another broadcast, first section of the outstanding autobiography of the late Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy. We will pick up on chapter 5, Time Itself Was Ready. That's where section 2 will begin. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone to join us, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.com/1race. That is the number 1. Address again, tiny.com/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. Click the link that says free VOPE line. When you click that link, it will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put your real name in. You can use a nickname. You can click random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the program, and we can get you on the line. The folks who dialed in who have commentary, who would like to share, your hands should be up. Feel free to chime in, share any thoughts you have on what we heard in the first section.
Not be heard.
Yes, sir, we can hear you. Rob in Wisconsin, I believe.
Yes, it is. Greetings to Gus, the rest of the listeners and the callers. Calling in from a different number.
Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Is that better?
Speak a little bit more. Let's see. It's still a little low. As much volume as you can give us, that would be helpful.
Can you hear me now?
Better. Yes, better.
Okay. calling in from a different number. A few changes going on that I'll share later. I listened to the archive of the first audio session, and I was very impressed. Second audio session, I'm very impressed as well, having recently ended a attempted survival unit that lasted for 10 years, hearing the level of commitment, hearing the just how delicately one was handled, male and female. It's beautiful to hear. And just how courageous Mrs. Coretta Scott King was. Her strength really, really stands out. I think that she is a perfect example of an attempted black woman. Thank you.
Hello? Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, you should be with us as well.
Pardon?
I'm sorry?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. Also, peace to you, Rob. I hope all is well with you. And it's great to hear from you this evening as well. I just wanted to just say that. I agree with you emphatically, Gus. This reading is, this book is outstanding. And it just really is a joy to look forward to reading something of this nature. And Mrs. Coretta Scott King is just incredible and dynamic, and it's beautiful to be able to kind of get her take on so much. She gives a lot of insight, and her memory seems to be quite impeccable. I wanted to touch on something from last week that I thought was important that I didn't get to discuss. It was actually on page 38, where she writes, "What impressed me most about Martin was his integrity and how he himself told me about the quote unquote other woman, so to speak. He had been dating a young lady back in Atlanta rather seriously. My friend Mary Powell had already told me about her, but it was so comforting to hear Martin's confession from his own lips. His honesty was the quality that touched my heart most deeply. I felt he was trustworthy. From the very beginning of our relationship, he was the kind of man who could not keep a secret. If he did something wrong, no matter how big or small, he was so tortured by his conscience that he was miserable until he discussed it and asked forgiveness. He was constantly examining himself to see if there was any sin that had crept into his life. Was he being selfish? Was his commitment as total as it should be? Had he been insensitive? Had he overlooked someone who had done something nice? He was always looking for a sin to clean up, starting with the sins in himself." And that paragraph, especially when she says the very last line where she said he was looking for sins to clean up, starting with sins in himself, reminded me of the brilliant Neely Fuller Jr. when he talks about Black people not being disparaging to other Black people. And I've heard him say numerous times, you know, whenever you want to talk about a coon, look at the person in the mirror, and he would always reference himself first. And I just find that to be just an important aspect of us trying to fight the system, is for us to look inward, because we've been so acculturated to turning outward, as far as just how we look at things negatively and we express it outwardly towards other people that look like us. So I just find that to be something that's very important. And it's something that you've also stressed too, Gus, over the years that I've listened to you. And I actually thank you for that as well, because that's something that I try to focus on within myself. On page 42, she writes, "Daddy King was a child. When Daddy King was a child, a white man stripped him naked and beat him for not giving him a pail of water Daddy King was carrying home to his mother. When his mother, Delia, heard about the incident, she made him promise not to tell his father, fearing he would kill the white man and bring retribution down on the entire community. But far from letting the matter drop, she picked up a club, found the man, and beat him herself. In time, the story did get around, and James King went after the white man with a gun. The Kings had to go into hiding until the controversy blew over." And I just found that a brilliant example of Black self-respect, that his mom did so, to take it into her own hands to beat the white man who assaulted her child. And when I read about her saying that she thought he would kill the white man, it made me think of something that took place in my own family. Actually, it was my wife's family. My wife's father was originally from Americus, Georgia. And from what we understand, his father, who was actually James Sr. as well, he was a junior, actually did kill a white man for being racist towards him. And that's what actually forced the family to relocate to New Jersey. And as we've talked about before in this program about not talking about things that have happened to us, that is something that remained quite a well-kept secret in the family. Not many people talked about it. And I only heard about it like once. And so definitely Black people do practice self-respect, even to the point of killing white people when it's necessary. And of course, we have to make the proper decisions after the fact to protect ourselves or make moves to change the environment so that they don't become even more terroristic. On tape, writes, "Because there were no hotels that accommodated Blacks in the South, we spent our wedding night in a home of a friend who happened to be an undertaker. Throughout our marriage, Martin would sometimes jokingly reminisce about this. Honey, do you remember when we spent our honeymoon at a funeral parlor?" And I found that very telling, that you would have a memory that the society you were in, dominated by racist white supremacists, was just so all pervasive that you couldn't even have a decent honeymoon. You had to have a honeymoon at a friend's place that happened to be a funeral parlor. I mean, that should really give us pause for thought, just as far as the things that we've been through. Even when she discussed the birth of her daughter, and it was, only under the circumstances of overcrowding that the hospital would allow white and black children to be birthed in the same area. Outside of that context, it would keep them completely separated. So I just think that's something to ponder, just as far as just the terror that our ancestors had gone through. On page 48, she writes, since the Montgomery bus boycott begun 1 month before, we had experienced a barrage of harassing phone calls, including one particularly frightening caller who told Martin, that if he didn't leave town in 3 days, they were going to bomb the house and kill our baby and me. Even so, I convinced myself that the call was an empty threat. When people call you up and tell you they're going to do something, they're probably not going to do it, I reasoned. They are just trying to scare you. But tonight I realized just how deadly real those threats can be, or could be, And I just think that that's telling about just a lot of black people, even to this day, don't really understand the system of white supremacy, and that just showed at that point she wasn't thinking white people were capable of what they were capable of. And one thing that I've learned in this life, just from research and just from things that have happened to me, is to believe what they say, take them very seriously, and if you have to handle your business, handle your business, because they're gonna do whatever they are threatening to do. And that's something that I think a lot of us just don't really do. I think a lot of us tend to think of white people as just other regular people, and that they're not going to do these things. They're not as violent as they are. They're not as sexually deviant and terroristic as they are, but this is who they are. This is their entire way of life. It's their religion. It's in their DNA, and we have to really get that understanding through our heads and start to make counter-racist decisions to counter that sort of holistic violence that is visited upon us on a daily basis. Thank you very much, Gus, and I'll mute my line and give someone else the opportunity to speak.
Yes, sir. Appreciate that, Roz. Anybody that we have not heard from, other callers that we have not heard from who have a hand up, line should be open.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
I heard both.
Go ahead, Firefire.
There you go.
Greetings, everyone. Just like to first speak on the continued high level of terrorism. I think Mrs. King did a great job of illustrating it for anybody who would want to know on how it was during that time. Even before she met her husband, and in turn on how it evolved with the both. I don't know about anybody else, but I had a feeling at one part of the read that she actually was being recruited by the King family in a shrewd sort of way. With the idea in mind of the way Daddy King went about the means of acting like he was basically wanted his son to focus on the ladies in Atlanta, Georgia. Oh yes, by the way, this particular portion of the reading was within your favorite subject, Gus, the people activity of sex. But I had a feeling that they would in a shrewd way recruiting her. She gave some kind of clues to that also from the standpoint of black males and black females. Of course, from logic standpoint, under the global system of racism, white supremacy, it's never going to be very good at all. Nobody's relationship is going to be as good as it could be. As Mr. Fuller said, the best thing that we can do is agree that to agree on things and know everything about that other person to the most intrinsic as you possibly can, And as he states all the time, problems are solved through questions and answers before the two people even get serious with one another. That holds accurate in my mind as far from a logical standpoint. Even she participated somewhat when she mentioned in the quote unquote phoniness, you know, of romance with the idea of deliberately stating that she, I'm going to go somewhere else instead of go and see your parents and with the idea of mind of testing him, so to speak. And the answer is supposed to be he's going to get angry. If he gets angry, then he really cares and, you know, that sort of thing. But anyway, it seems like a long way around doing things. Nevertheless, one thing about it, and that makes logical sense, if you're going to be committed to that other person like she was, to whereas you willfully put your life in danger on a daily basis, that's one heck of a bar. And I don't care if it's male, female, 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 male, male, as far as have the desire to still be around that person, or you are around each other. It's a very, very profound thing, you know, when you go through that with somebody. So I can see on how they were able to coexist. Although it wasn't as long as she would have liked it for obvious reasons. But those are some of the observations that I had. Let me think of something else. I couldn't take notes because I was on the road, but that's all I can think of right now. I'll say some other things when it comes to mind. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers. Very interesting points. A lot of them were the exact same points that I had noticed. But I was intrigued with Dr. King, like most men at that time in the 50s, you know, didn't want his wife working. And judging by the model of the car that he was driving when he picked her up, you know, during college, he had a late model automobile. And he wanted his wife to know how to cook, or, you know, she said burn, you know, that was important. It's like a cultural thing, you know, for Black people. Cooking is a major part of, you know, like we call culture, but it's just what people do, what Black people do. And she mentioned that when people call you up and tell you that they're going to do something to you, they usually wasn't going to do anything. And I think that when she made that statement, that belief system was based upon maybe the way Black people react, because that's just not accurate interpretation of, you know, what it means to be white. They make these threats and then usually have the firepower to back them up. And she, usually when you're talking about even Black people, if they call you up or if they tell you what they plan to do, I would suggest taking any threats serious. It was an incident that happened to me on federal installation where a guy wanted to take me out to the parking lot, I guess, you know. And by the time that I got through telling him about the consequences of a threat on government property, you know, and what I could do, you know, to him, It was just for the knowledge that I have about the system and listening to this show, reason why I didn't have this guy prosecuted in the first place. But back to the book, Daddy King had a miserable childhood, stripped and whipped by a white man. And then after retaliating against the racism that the King family was enduring, they had to go into hiding. And it just goes to show that even an attempt to protect your family can put you in harm's way. When you're dealing with murderous, cowardly, racist whites, where they were tossing urine on black people, burning crosses, making death threats, and actually bomb terrorists were operating. You know, like I said, murderous, spineless white people that bombed women and children. You know, and another thing that perplexed me was the influence that Gandhi had in Martin Luther King's belief system, because Gandhi basically was a rebel to the Hindu religion. But at this particular time, Martin Luther King Jr. had to have heard about the four assassination attempts on Gandhi's life and then his final assassination in 1948. And it just, you know, kind of boggles the mind that if this is what happened to this particular guy, why would you want to follow his thought pattern and end up in a similar situation? But I also noted that he had a degree, he was getting his PhD, I guess, in systematic theology, which sounds to me like a form of brainwashing and nonviolence versus pacifist. I was sort of confused upon that, but I don't see much difference in that, I guess, in, you know, doing nothing, because none of these plans or strategies has worked up to this point. Even the so-called redemptive love episode that she talked about, nothing has helped us in dealing with whites. I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Right on, Mr. Demery Four. Yes, Emmy, we can hear you.
Fantastic. So I don't hope I'm not cutting you off. Greetings, everybody. This is Emmy. I have taken a couple of notes on this section, and I took a couple on the first. Overall, I have to say that so far, thus far, the autobiography is extremely well written and a beautiful listen. Like, it feels good to the ears the way that it's written. It creates such a beautiful image. Like, you're actually able to follow the story. So I really do appreciate that. Just a couple of things. I'm not really sure about the whole voice. I don't know if it's meant to always be read like that. And to me, it actually doesn't even sound like Miss Felicia Rashad. I looked it up. There's another woman who is narrating too, but I don't know if maybe she narrates some other part, but it doesn't even sound like Felicia Rashad to me, unless she's like holding her voice in another way so that she doesn't sound exactly just like herself. But that's neither here nor there. It was just something that I kind of noticed, because I've listened to Miss Rashad speak often. Like, she, you know, will do interviews and stuff, and it really, anyway. I think it cannot be overstated that intelligence and wisdom has nothing to do with a degree. And I can't remember who said it in this part, but it's like common sense running around people with PhDs. And I really wish that we could kind of get to a place where we really understood that, and that wasn't something that's just like a colloquialism or a proverb or something, because a lot of, like, it's manifested itself in so many ways, and believing that in order to be educated, or excuse me, in order to be smart, intelligent, or wise, or knowledgeable, that it's somehow intrinsically linked to having some degree. And oftentimes, it's really the more degrees you have, or the more so-called education you have, kind of the dumber you are. And I know that I remember Dr. Welsing speaking, I think about her grandmother might have even said that, like, the more school they get, the dumber they get, or something like that. And so I really appreciated that being emphasized a couple of times in the first, in last week's reading and in this week's reading, when she's talking specifically, like, about her mother, who only had a fourth grade education, but is way wittier, more real, more aware than people who have degrees. In listening to this, I really thought about that white boy that she dated, and I think she might have underplayed that a little bit, but she was really, really, really hurt by that. Especially, and I feel like he didn't have to do a whole lot to get her to love him, whereas black boys are having to prove themselves, have all these special characteristics. Like, it would have been really interesting to see what this white boy looked like. He, for all we know, could have been like 5'5", you know, like even shorter than Dr. King. But I guess, you know, maybe that was okay because he was white. Like, because he was white, he was able to get away with a couple of things. And then I also thought about when she goes through a bunch of lists, like, will the child be half Jewish, half white? And I was like, wait a minute. So Jewish is white. What? Like, and that's just me. But I picked up on that, like, maybe I'm the one totally confused about who these Jews are. But anyway, so, and then I also thought it was interesting. I said, I mean, West Virginia is the South. Like, what do you mean? So how dare you be in school in the North? Like, sometimes I'm unforgiving of so white people who are ignorant or who don't know things. That doesn't make any sense to me, even then. If you're from West Virginia, then you know what West Virginia is like. So you bring this black girl to West Virginia and say, let's go to this restaurant, and then there's this awkward moment. Like, these aren't conversations, and then she could die. Like, how dare you be so, I'm so called ignorant, and then it's like, well, then what about me? And now it's this weird thing, and this is now when we're confronted with what it means to be in a so-called interracial relationship. Like, I reject that all the way around, that these white people really just, you know, are just so oblivious when being white is, like, predicated on people being black. Like, that you're not even white unless there are black people. So anyway, I too noted the cooking. I think that that's, you know, very cute. I think it's nice to hear the love stories behind some of our so-called leaders and how things come. And I'm a big proponent of the cooking. And yeah, I thought it was kind of cute that everybody ate and, you know, it was something. I also appreciated that they didn't have the traditional language in their vows, but not just that they didn't have it, like, whatever, but that Dr. King and Daddy King were actually okay and accepted that. Like, that didn't become some kind of, oh, you done brought this, you know, feminist woman down here who don't want to have these, you know, it didn't turn into anything like that. And so I think that makes the case that black men have always been accepting of black women being not in the same, you know, just black women being black women and understanding all that that might entail and include and all that kind of stuff, that we're not white women. Therefore, all that other stuff, you know, that's white people stuff. This is us over here. So we're going to do our thing and not necessarily have to be so quote unquote white with it, if that's making any sense. Because there's this conversation all the time that black men are just only trying to be like white men. And that's not true, evidenced in this case right here. So I appreciate this text, because all of her stories can be used, like, her memory is very on point. So we can use these things to say, well, look, here's an example of this, an example of that, an example of this, an example of that. And I appreciate that, because I reject that conversation that black men are always trying to keep black women in some kind of role or some kind of way. I don't agree with that at all. hearing being tossed out of the cars. Now, this is like a theme, and I'm grateful she told this story in her autobiography, because I actually did not know that even children or adults were actually throwing their pee on people as they drove past. Not that that's outside of like something I could fathom white people doing. It's just something I don't think I've heard that they've done. And then that puts it alongside other examples of white people using urine. Like the whole, there was, I need to find this thing, but it was like white people use the world as their toilet or something like that. And I remember I linked it to the world is the white male's brothel. It's like something with this like bodily fluids, genitals, disrespect, oppression, terrorism kind of thing. Like that's really, really gross on many, many levels. Not it just being thrown on you, but like, so what did you do? Like, did you actually like pee at home and then bring it in the car waiting to pass like a black person on the road? Or did you say, oh, there's a black person, I think I have like a cup in my bag or whatever, and then pee in the bag and then throw it? I mean, there's so many things when you have to think of what it goes. Or did you just like stand up against the window and do it like that? Like, in which case, neither one of those, like all of them show deeper, deeper, deeper issues with white psychology. Like that it's either premeditated, spontaneous, like whatever it is, it's really something that cannot not be further psychoanalyzed. It's not as simple as just, oh, I threw a rock at someone. There's a rock, I threw it at someone. To pee or throw pee on someone, it requires that you do something really, really gross and filthy to do. So which means that white people, it's not ignorance. It's very deliberate. Like, oh, goodness.
This will be our last comment.
Okay, then let me pick a good one. I guess this one would just be the one note from the first reading. The whole concept and term of the beloved community, I'm not even sure where that really came from. Is that like a concept that some white person came up with? And I just think that it's further confusing. So I understand that she's in her time and in her place and stuff like that. Like, you know, VGQ, we don't have, at this time, Dr. Welsing hasn't done her work. Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. hasn't done his. So there's still a lot of confusion about what's going on. Is it being a system? So we're doing the best that we can do. But I just feel like the whole concept of nonviolence and this whole beloved community thing just further confuses everybody, because it's not that we couldn't have it. It's not us that's preventing it. And so anyway, with that, thank you all for listening.
Yes, ma'am. I used my mute button to have a grand cackle when you were talking about the urine. As we get our next caller, this will be a quiz. I was so disappointed last week that nobody remembered Dr. Welsing talking about the incident at Antioch College where the president had a dog named Nigger that Mrs. King mentioned last week in the text. So we'll try a quiz again. This will be for people who have been listening to the book club. Urine being thrown on black people as an act of racism has come up in the context of White Supremacy's book club on more than one occasion. If you can recall some of those, feel free to share. But more than once, this has come up in the book club if you want to, you know, talk about pattern. In fact, it has come up so frequently, Dr. Welsing mentioned this on a program, and I just said this has become a whole advertisement for the book club. I started reading some of the sections from the book, and she took time to respond to this pattern of racist behavior. But before I move on, I had such a big joke about spontaneously doing this. I cannot imagine or fathom how one would spontaneously throw urine on someone. That just doesn't seem possible. At any rate, the caller, we had another person who dialed in. Last four digits, 1989. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Greetings, Gus, and all the listeners. I just wanted to be real quick. The one thing that I was wondering about, because I don't have the book, so I appreciate you putting these up to where for those of us who don't have the book, we can still follow along via the audio book. But the one thing that grabbed a hold to me, well, there are several things, but I'm going to make this real quick, and that was the father being stripped and whipped by the white man. Now, that's something that's that happens a lot in the South during that particular time, and it hit me so closely is that I wonder how long did it take Miss King to get that out of her father, because this same thing happened with my family. The reason why I'm here in Tennessee, actually, because my father's family is from Georgia. Now, he was sharecropping down in Georgia, and he was racing the mules that he used to work with, and he ended up killing them. And he had this same thing happen to him, and before he died, he picked his family up, and he moved up here to Tennessee. So my question is that how long it took her to find out about that, because my mother never even knew about that, and I didn't find out about that until I was a teenager. So the dynamic between that part just specifically grabbed a hold to me, and I was wondering what would be your thoughts on that type of traumatization happening to one person and then it being conveyed to another. And I'll mute myself.
Interesting. We'll get thoughts on, I think they call that intergenerational transfer of trauma. We'll kind of get people's thoughts on that as we proceed. The caller who dialed in, 5771, did you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the callers. Interesting book, as everybody has noted here. Got a couple of notes. I think his name was James King. Dada King's father was abusive to his wife, but also she noted that he was a victim of racism, experienced racial trauma and racial terrorism. I think Dr. Joy DeGruy called that PTSD. So basically a lot of the behaviors that he displayed to his family was because of the fact that he was a victim of racist or racial terrorism. Big ups to Dada King's mother in regards to black self-defense, in regards to getting a hold of that white man who basically terrorized her child. Also to the theme of bombing, you know, with the, you know, with the threatening of the bombing of the King family, you know, you notice that is a theme that is widespread among civil rights movement, including the most famous one of the bombing of the church in Birmingham, where the three girls were killed. And, you know, when I think of bombing, it basically means warfare. And, you know, white white supremacy is basically warfare against us. So this is something that, you know, we have to consider looking into in regards to waking up and realizing this is war against white people. And, you know, they got the message up front with the bombing going on. And I also took a note about the urine. That is a very popular theme as well, you know, white people urinating on blacks in regards to including women and children. And it's interesting because it reminded me of Long Walk to Freedom with Madiba, how he and the prisoners in the prison, the guards used to urinate on him. So it's like that is a running theme with white people in regards to degrading black folks. So that is something that that's a running theme as well with white people and white terrorism. I hate to say I missed the first session, but I got a chance to catch up on the archive, but took a couple of notes on that. But I'll save it for now because I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people. But I will mute my line for now.
Right on. Our lovely black mother in Michigan, did you have commentary?
Good evening, Gus. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry for raising my hand late, but I did want to try to give some comments. I just caught up with the sessions. I listened to the archive, and I am enjoying this book tremendously. All I've been thinking about is Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Shout out to Pam, but that has been just sticking out. Her strength, Mrs. King's strength, is what has been really just highlighted in my mind just hearing her story. I'm waiting on the book, but just listening to just her strength, you know, and it's been fueled by her true love that that she has for her husband. And so I just thought about as a mother and just the thought of someone bombing my home and me just staying by his side, you know, and just like, you know, I think someone else mentioned just that, you know, putting your life on the line for a bigger cause. It just really sticks out to me, but it's all fueled with her love for her husband. And so that really stuck out to me. Another thing that I made notation of is she said something about how the threats that they received, she never thought that, you know, the white people or just people would follow through on the threats. And I thought about how white people know that there's really no consequences for their mistreatment of black people. And so I look at just from the, just hearing, you know, over and over again from slavery, civil rights movement, all through up until today, there's no consequences. They get rewarded for mistreating us, depending, and it doesn't matter the degree for the most part. But black people, we have, or non-white people have the consequences, you know, and, you know, we're the ones who think twice or think about the consequences. And so they have no regard for what they do to us. And so to bomb the home and then to make that phone call, I wish I would have gotten all of you or something to that point where the phone call right after the bombing, I mean, it was just unbelievable. I also thought about, you know, the Christian religion and how this desire to love this enemy, to love the hate out of them. And, you know, even today, with all the things that's going on today, I just hear this over and over again that, you know, we're just going to love this hate out of them. And we've seen over and over again, just hearing this story, all the it's just been proven. You can't love the hate out of their hearts. You know, they have proven what how they feel about non-white people. We know why. And I just, hopefully, you know, just I always think about Neely Fuller when he was saying, you know, the purpose of history is to try to learn from the mistakes that was made in the past. And just hearing this, you know, her point of view, especially, you know, living in the house and being by the side of Dr. King and just really experiencing this on a different level. I'm just listening for just the mistakes and how to just do better moving forward. So that's just kind of the notes that I've taken. And I am looking forward to the next portion. I'll mute my line.
We have such participation, I might not get to comment very much. The other folks we have not heard from, the caller at 3637 and the caller at 5764. Did you all have commentary you wanted to add?
Maybe Hertz?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, guys, to closing listeners. Jarrell from Brooklyn calling in. I missed the first part of the reading, but I've been following since last week. I had a question. I just wanted to get people's thoughts on. I know it hasn't came up yet, but there's a lot of I hear a lot of whites when they talk about Dr. King, they like to bring up, you know, extra married, you know, affairs and things like that.
Is your question related to the text? Because if it's like. Because of what it sounds like, that might be something that's later in the text. I prefer to just be like kind of random and all over the place. Like it should be something related to the text.
Okay, no. I got something with the text, so I'll save that question. But the other question I had is, I don't understand like the mindset where you know Miss King and others, you know, in a you know dealing with blatant racism like that, where they have the thoughts of even. You know, thinking that, you know, oh, these people need love and these people need care and stuff like that. When they're facing blatant racism, people throwing urine, people get lynched, things like that. I have a hard time understanding that mindset. So, you know, I just wanted to get people's thoughts on that. And I'll mute my line.
Right on. The other caller that we have not heard from, did you want to comment as well?
Hello, I would like to comment.
Yes, ma'am.
From the 712. I want to kind of ping off what the last caller was saying. I mean, and what I wanted to say was the terror that our people are under and were under. I mean, the bombings. It keeps coming up in every book, the bombings. And that might speak to why, I mean, it seems irrational, but why you might want to find some great white person. And maybe, I mean, I just think that has something to do with it. But I just finished reading the first reading of it. I've been excited to hear about Coretta Scott King because I really didn't hear anything about her. So, but that's all I really wanted to say. It's just what the last caller said, the terror that we are under and were under. I mean, it keeps coming up in every reading. So that might have something to do with why you could be looking for a good white person. And I'll mute my line.
Amen. Great man. terrorism, very important term in the psychological impact of being a victim of generational terrorism. I will have to be efficient with my commentary. So in chapter 3, where she talked about, she said, I had learned from my mother, who always behaved with great dignity. Reminded me of Mr. Fuller when he talks about a dignified slave and a silly one. In the South, since black women were so disrespected by whites, our response was to push our shoulders back, keep our heads high, and walk with dignity, looking as if we had oil wells in our backyard. I just thought that was interesting. It reminded me, I think, of some of the commentary on respectability politics, that you can do all of that, and it makes no difference at all. We got a bottle of urine waiting for you, even if you did literally own oil wells. We still got a bottle of urine waiting for you, too. You're just a nigga to us as well. The next portion, when she said, you know how difficult it is to find intelligent, stable, well-adjusted men. This is the conversation when she was talking with her sister, Edith, about, you know, should I get serious and marry this Martin fella? Man, are you telling me in the 1950s it was that hard with all that black male privilege and black male patriarchy that even then it was hard to find intelligent, stable, well-adjusted black males? Wow, that seems like a big hit on the notion of black male privilege, but, you know, maybe I'm just a little ignorant. Next, let's see. Man, when she talks about when Daddy King was a child and this white man stripped him naked and beat him, delectable Negro. That is a sexual act. That is sexual abuse of a child, to have a grown white person. That, I thought that's why delectable Negro was so important, to think of that as a homoerotic racist act, for a grown racist white man to strip a black child naked and to beat them. And particularly if you remember from Delectable Negro, when he talked about how white people would read a book like Uncle Tom's Cabin as pornography, they would get sexually aroused reading about black people being enslaved. Can you imagine? You get to be a white man and you can beat a black child in person, strip them naked and beat them? Continuing. Yeah, how did she get that story? I would be very eager to know about that as well, from Daddy King. I thought it was so important, including the story about her, Daddy King's mom, the black self-respect, going to defend her child. I think there are a lot of stories like that where black people have retaliated, killed white people, responded with counterviolence, and they had to leave the town. I think it's important because so often, even people like Dr. King and his family will get branded as these are just cowards. You know, these are just no count, shuffling, head scratching, coon, Sambo, niggers. And it's niggers like them. That's why we haven't solved this problem, because we just take anything white people hand out. Nothing could be further from the truth. I say that all the time. That is such monumental disrespect. And it's just flat inaccurate if you do any reading at all. That's why I love reading histories, biographies, because you get to learn a lot of accurate information, that there is a lengthy record of black people not taking any sort of abuse from white people and doing everything that they could, including killing racists. Extremely important. I'm so glad that that was included in the text. I thought it was great, her discarding the language. Really appreciated Emmy's point as well about, with all of this black male privilege, it didn't seem like it was a big deal, them discarding the language of obeying and submitting to her husband. It seems pretty, I guess, what they would call liberal views for that time, particularly from black males in the church. Supposed to be a lot of black male privilege there. Where I thought as well, this reminded me, it sound what they call gallows humor. When you're in a bad situation and you just start to make jokes about how bad your situation is, when they, because of white supremacy and they couldn't get a hotel and so they had to stay at the funeral parlor after they got married, I thought that was gallows humor. Do you remember we spent our honeymoon in the funeral parlor? That's the sort of gallows humor. I think there's a lot of that as a result of racism. Since we're running short on time, since we had so much participation, which is great, the most important point that I wanted to get in, I had a lot of notes for chapter four. The most important note that I want to get, or two, I'll make sure I get it. Number one, that it was a white woman. Again, so frequently when we talk about racism, white supremacy, it is the man, that it was a white woman who called to say, I'm sorry we didn't kill all you bastards after their house was bombed. I also, the portion where she says, after the bombing, seeing the glass, feeling the explosion was my wake-up call. I was shocked into a new reality. The perpetrators would do anything, even commit murder, to stop us. It sank in again. That portion right there, I was stymied. I said, wait a minute, maybe I'm not reading the same book, or maybe my reading comprehension is low. They say black people have that problem. This is the same book where last week she started off this book with her house when she was 15 being bombed in Alabama. She continued, the family prayed, thankfully no one was injured. House is bombed, they move forward. Pray for enemies. They continue, and her dad won't sell his sawmill, and they burn his sawmill down. She talks about the number of black people lynched in the United States at this time period and mentions that her great uncle was lynched. And I think a white woman came and said, hey, come look at your great uncle, telling one of her family members, come look at your, you know, great uncle hanging up in the tree. And they use him for target practice. If you have experienced all of this, why would you need a wake-up call to understand that white people are waging war against black people and that they can and will do anything? Your house has already been bombed. You've already, even though she wasn't there, but your house has already been bombed. You already are very aware of what white people are capable of. That to me, I thought was so profound, because I think a lot of times we will get frustrated at black people because they don't understand racism, or they don't agree with our view on racism, or maybe they don't grasp how serious this problem is. And I just, apparently white people have done an extremely good job, whatever it is, if it's a combination of terrorism, of brain damage, of fear, of us having a difficult time being honest about it, where black people can experience extraordinary terrorism and still have a very difficult time grasping, understanding, accepting, yes, this is what it means to be white. Perpetual war against black people. Anything can be done to the Negroes. For whatever reason, we just don't grasp that, even when we have had it happen to us repeatedly. I thought that was so profound. I'll stop there. We have about 2 minutes. Does anybody have anything that they can get in 2 minutes before we get to the second audio segment? Hey. everyone satisfied? Nothing else they needed to add? I know we had questions on the table about generational trauma. I had my own quiz, I guess, for folks who've been listening to the book club. We did have one of those books mentioned, Long Walk to Freedom, Madiba. He did mention more than once that the racist guards in South Africa would urinate on he and other prisoners at Robben's Island, where he was caged for 3 decades. Any other thoughts?
Was it possible that the urine throwing was at Little Rock, the high school? I'm trying to recall it, whether or not that was done there.
It may have been. I'm not recalling. Off top, I'll have to go back to check and see, because we did do two books, Warriors Don't Cry, Melba Batillo Beals, and Elizabeth and Hazel. We did back-to-back books on the Little Rock incident. It would seem like that would definitely be one where it's likely that some urine was thrown.
Also, I think with the urine, that Dr. Welsing would have a field day with that, because for one thing, animals, they urinate through their to identify their territory. Also, from the standpoint of primarily white males who do a lot of hunting, and they use the urine of animals to stalk their prey, quote unquote. So it's a lot of interesting psychological things that involve in a sick way that just glaring of a white person and their shenanigans and what they do on a global basis when they want to psychologically and physically humiliate their victims.
We'll leave it there. Did anybody else have anything they needed to get in like 20 seconds? If not, we'll get to the second audio segment, so we'll have time to comment afterwards. 20-second comment, or everybody good?
I think Dr. Wilson did go over that urination with white people with a caller, because I listened to the archives a lot, and she did. I think a caller asked Dr. Wilson about that, and she went over that. So, I mean, I don't know what archive it was.
We'll leave it there. She did
go over that.
She did. That was at the end of 2014. It came up twice during the same program. I can post it. As I read her a section from Madiba's Long Walk to Freedom, she talked about it then, and then it came back. It was karma specifically. She called in about it, and it came up again. So you can go back. It was right at the end of 2014. Get to the second audio segment. We'll get Roz's commentary after we get back. Good to hear from all the callers. Context of white supremacy. My love, my life, my legacy, the late Mrs. Coretta Scott King, audio segment number 2.
5. Time itself was ready. Nothing happens in a vacuum, and especially not the Montgomery bus boycott. Not only did Mrs. Parks, my husband, and all the other protagonists have to be in place, but the social and atmospheric forces had to be right. There had been a shift in the political landscape, a buildup of climatic changes, almost like the moments before a rainstorm when you can sense the thunder and smell the chill before the lightning flash. From afar, we heard the thunder rolling in. There was the case of Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas. Through the hard work of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, headed by Thurgood Marshall, and the appointment of Justice Earl Warren to the Supreme Court, virtually 50 years of legal degradation ended in 1954, when the court reversed its ancient, unworkable opinion that separate but equal educational facilities met the requirements of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Marshall's team put in thousands of hours of legwork, wearing out shoe leather and making financial sacrifices, traveling and interviewing, to prove to white folks what black folks had always known. Imposed segregation by the majority falls unequally and tyrannically upon the minority. Finally, it seemed as though the court, if not on our side, could at least understand the injustices and indignities perpetrated on black Americans in America, their homeland. After a blackout of more than 50 years, it appeared that the highest court was once again on the side of justice. A breath of freedom was stirring in the land. Although for a while it looked like nothing different was happening in Montgomery, at least there was an upsurge of hope. Maybe, just maybe, blacks were not to be locked into degradation forever. Then on December 1, 1955, the quiet and dignified Rosa Parks, a 42-year-old seamstress who had been trained at the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, a training ground for labor organizers, was arrested when she refused the driver's request to move to the back of the bus. The response from the black community was disciplined outrage, demonstrated by an unprecedented 381-day boycott. But the question in my mind as I looked back over the years was, why then? There had been other women arrested before Mrs. Parks. For example, in March 1955, 15-year-old Claudette Colvin refused to give up her seat to a white passenger. The enraged driver called a policeman. Several showed up, and the officers ordered Colvin to get up. When she refused, they dragged her kicking and screaming hysterically off the bus, and she was carted off to jail, where she was charged with misconduct and resisting arrest. Her case was widely discussed in black circles. At that time, Martin served on a committee that protested to the city and bus company officials. The committee was received politely, but nothing happened. Further, the jailing of Mrs. Parks, who was also a volunteer secretary for the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP, was hardly one of the worst abuses by the buses, whose brutal, segregated system had existed for half a century. Documented reports by the Women's Political Council, WPC, a group of politically active black women that had been working for change since the 1940s, showed hundreds of complaints against the bus company. There had been a mother who boarded a bus with two small infants in her arms. Since there were no whites on the bus, she placed the two babies on the empty front seat while she searched in her purse for a dime. The horrified driver demanded that the black, dirty brats be removed from the seat reserved for whites. To back up his demand, he lunged the bus forward with such a terrific jerk that the infants were thrown into the aisle. In another instance, a mentally defective but harmless black man was severely beaten by a bus driver for walking in front of a bus. In 1952, an intoxicated black man argued with a bus driver over whether he had put a dime into the slot. When the police came upon the scene, they shot and killed the man as he climbed off the bus. The authorities ruled the shooting of the unarmed black man justifiable homicide. In fact, the Northern-owned Montgomery bus line was the most potent, degrading symbol of Southern segregation in the town. Although 70% of its passengers were black, the system was operated so as to make blacks feel less than human. Imagine what it was like to get on a Montgomery bus with your children. Not only had there been worse atrocities than the Parks incident, but other leaders had challenged the bus company. Reverend Vernon Johns called on blacks to confront them. When no one would take the dare, Johns stopped riding. It was a long-standing theme of the Women's Political Council that blacks should boycott the bus company. The cause had been there. The agony had been there. The leaders had been there. After a half-century of pain and humiliation, why did December 5, 1955 become the day that the Montgomery bus boycott finally began? Why did the cries of, "We have taken this long enough," soar through the black community with the power of a national anthem? It was as if every tear, every groan, every hurt had been stored up somewhere, and Rosa Parks' arrest was the last indignity. The dam burst. The flow of agony ran over with such force that it submerged fear, mistrust, doubt, and all the previous beliefs that social conditions existing for decades would continue unchecked. As a result, the desire to stand tall, to be confident in times of trouble, surfaced. It was as if souls were being liberated. But the boycott could also be credited to something Martin used to call the divine dimension. At the January 30, 1956 mass meeting, 2 months into the boycott, he said, "There comes a time when time itself is ready for a change," he offered. Often he would point to the zeitgeist as being responsible for the birth of the movement. The leaders do not ask for the task, but are tracked down by the spirit of the times until it consumes them. They reach a point where they become the symbol of both the disaffected and the movement swirling around them. It was the spirit of the times that tracked Martin, coupled with the Holy Spirit that motivated, inspired, and directed him. He became that lead symbol. From black barbershops and beauty schools to Negro schools and Alabama State University, the cry was the same. On Friday, December 2, 1955, in response to Parks's arrest, E.D. Nixon, a fiery local civil rights leader, called Martin. By then, Nixon was echoing what many black people in Montgomery were feeling. "We have taken this type of thing too long," he said. "I feel the time has come to boycott the buses. It's the only way to make the white folks see that we will not take this sort of thing any longer." Martin offered his church, Dexter, as a meeting place to discuss the idea of a boycott. To his delight, 40 leaders showed up, representing every segment of African American life. They were doctors, lawyers, union leaders, federal government employees, and a great number of ministers. The ministers were important because of their influence on their congregations, of course, but their presence also showed a meeting of the minds with Martin and Ralph, who had been preaching the social gospel that religion had to deal not only with heaven, but with the hell playing out on earth. The decision was unanimous. Yes, they would boycott. From that very first meeting, the Christian ministry provided the leadership of our struggle, and Christian ideals were its source. The Saturday before the boycott, Martin and other members of the committee hurried about, working out details with black-owned taxi companies and owners of private cars who would help transport people to and from work. Although I could not leave Yoki to help outside our home, our house initially served as a command post for the new group, which came to be named the Montgomery Improvement Association, MIA, and it was my responsibility to answer the telephone, which rang incessantly. People needed directions and encouragement. I also cooked the meals for the continuous meetings. During the boycott, some of the strategy was planned at my dinner table. Very often, I sat in on the meetings as part of the inner circle. Juanita Abernathy and the other ministers' wives and I often served as conduits between the press, the movement volunteers and staff, and our husbands, relieving some of the stress which built constantly from all directions. Eventually, people from all across the country and from many foreign countries made their way to our home to become a part of the Montgomery movement. Far too much of the valuable role that women played in the Montgomery movement and other such efforts has been lost to history. It should be remembered that it was Joanne Gibson Robinson, an English professor at Alabama State College and then president of the Women's Political Council, who put in place a plan for a citywide bus boycott more than a year before Mrs. Parks's arrest. Robinson and Mary Fair Burks, who was equally fervid, helped create and sustain the climate that supported the 1955 boycott. Robinson and her team played multiple roles during the boycott. She drove 6 hours a day for the carpool, helped shape policy as a member of the Montgomery Improvement Association's executive board, and played a central role in the start of the protest by producing and distributing thousands of leaflets announcing the boycott. Myriad other women were involved as well, making phone calls, organizing, hosting bake sales to raise funds, and so on. Women as old as 80 went to jail. One of our first challenges was determining how to reach the 50,000 black people in Montgomery, a problem that, much to our delight, was solved by one of the biggest enemies of our efforts, the white press. A white woman found one of our leaflets, which her maid had left in the kitchen. The enraged woman telephoned the local press to expose what her servant was up to, and their coverage spread the word better than we ever could have. As the countdown continued on Sunday morning, almost every African-American pastor in town urged his parishioners to honor the boycott. Not surprisingly, the news media mounted a fervent case against us. One morning paper wrote an article accusing the NAACP of planting Mrs. Parks on the bus and likened the boycott to the tactics of the White Citizens Council, a white supremacist group that had formed in 1954. These accusations really upset Martin. Instead of slinging off the comparisons, he struggled with the ethical question of whether he was doing the right thing. Alone in his study, he paced back and forth, caught up in self-examination. Finally, he wrote, "Our purposes are altogether different from those of the White Citizens Council. We were using this method to give birth to justice and freedom, and also to urge men to comply with the law of the land. Our concern would not be to put the bus company out of business, but to put justice in business. What we were really doing was withdrawing our cooperation from an evil system, rather than merely withdrawing our support from the bus company." On the eve of the boycott, I pondered with Martin the pros and cons of the movement long into the night, wondering whether we would succeed. We hardly slept. The next morning, we rose early and were dressed by 5:30 sharp. We woke in anticipation, not knowing what to expect. After having coffee and toast, I planted myself in front of the window to check out the first bus, which was to stop just 5 feet from our house. At 6 a.m., the bus rolled up right on time, headlights blazing through the December darkness. "Martin! Martin, come quickly!" I called. He ran in and stood beside me, taking my hand, his face lighting up with excitement. Not one person was on the bus. Then came the next bus. It, too, was empty. This was the most traveled line in the city. We were so happy that we could hardly find words to express our joy. Everywhere in the city that day, the scenario was the same. Sidewalks crowded with men and women trudging to work, students at Alabama State College walking or hitchhiking, people clustered in taxis. Some even rode mules. Others were in horse-drawn buggies, and a few were on bikes. Some people had to make treks as long as 12 miles that day. Never before had I seen such courage and unity in so many, from butlers to schoolteachers, from the maids to the ministers. Truly, as Martin said, a miracle had taken place. Instead of the 60% cooperation we had hoped for, we reached nearly 100%. The next bombshell was the news Martin brought me that evening about the activities that had happened on day one. Martin and Ralph had attended the 9:30 a.m. trial of Rosa Parks. After the judge heard the arguments, she was found guilty of disobeying the city's segregation laws and fined $14, including court costs. She appealed the case. This was one of the first clear-cut instances in which a black was convicted of disobeying segregation laws. Heretofore, such cases had either been dismissed or those involved had been charged with disorderly conduct. Had the DA known that the Parks case would evolve into a test of the validity of segregation laws and that it would fuel the protest, I am sure they would have dismissed the case. Later that afternoon, Martin went to a meeting with E.D. Nixon, Ralph Abernathy, and other organizers. Much to Martin's surprise, when he walked into the meeting, he was quickly named president of the Montgomery Improvement Association, with the understanding that the organization would continue the boycott until certain demands were met. When I heard the news, I wondered aloud, why Martin? Maybe because he was new in town. Maybe because others already had important assignments. Ralph had been made chairman of the committee and was asked to draw up its demands. In any event, here was Martin, home at 6 o'clock, confronting a stack of messages because the phone had been ringing all day in support of our cause. He updated me, telling me very hesitantly about his new position. I didn't need to be told of the danger that loomed ahead for any black person who stood up for his or her rights. Nevertheless, I reassured him. "You know that whatever you do, I am with you." Martin went off to his study to work on his address for the mass meeting that night at Holt Street Baptist Church. He had only 20 minutes to prepare for what he told me would be the most decisive speech of his life. Reporters and news cameras would be there to send his words around the world, and he confided to me that for a moment he almost panicked at the thought of what he was about to do. Beating back fear with prayer, Martin asked God to restore his balance and to be with me in a time when I need your guidance more than ever. Martin and Ralph had been debating whether the press would call their efforts a failure if only 500 people showed up that night, only half filling the 1,000-seat church. But when they got within 5 blocks of the church, they encountered a traffic jam. Cars were everywhere, in yards, parked on sidewalks. It looked as though someone were having a party. As they pressed their way in, they found about 1,000 people in the church and about 4,000 more milling around outside, a response that was much more than Martin and I could ever have imagined. When Martin and Ralph approached, someone saw them and announced that they were in the house. The crowd started applauding politely, then wildly. The space was so jammed that people had to lift Ralph and Martin above the crowd and pass them from hand to hand, over the heads of the crowd and to the platform. Opening an hour and a half late, the program started with Onward Christian Soldiers, which literally sounded like a 5,000-voice battle cry. When Martin was introduced, a cry went up. The cameras clicked. Without manuscript or notes, Martin retold the story of Mrs. Parks and reviewed the long history of abuses and insults that Negro citizens had experienced on city buses. He told the audience that there comes a time when people get tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression. He pleaded for unity. It is the great need of the hour. He cautioned against fear. Don't let anyone frighten you. We are not afraid of what we are doing because we are doing it within the law. He refuted the press's inappropriate comparisons between the movement and the Klan. There will be no crosses burned at any bus stops in Montgomery. There will be no white persons pulled out of their homes and taken out on some distant road and lynched for not cooperating. He reiterated that ours was a Christian movement. In all of our doings, in all of our deliberations, whatever we do, we must keep God at the forefront. Love is one of the pivotal points of the Christian faith. There is another side called justice. And justice is really love in calculation. Justice is love correcting that which revolts against love. He closed the speech by saying, "As we prepare ourselves for what lies ahead, let us go with a grim and bold determination that we are going to stick together. We are going to work together. Right here in Montgomery, when the history books are written in the future, someone will say, there lived a people, a black people, fleecy locks and black complexion, a people who had the moral courage to stand up for their rights, and thereby they injected a new meaning into the veins of history and of civilization." As Martin finished speaking, the audience rose, cheering in exultation. And in that speech, Martin laid the spiritual foundation, set the moral tone, and provided a model of courage for the movement that was born in Montgomery that very night. As Martin himself concluded that day, the real victory was in the mass meeting, where thousands of black people stood revealed with a new sense of dignity and destiny. Since I was under doctor's orders to remain at home following the birth of Yoki, I could not attend the meeting. However, Martin and I knew that the speech he would deliver would probably be one of the most important of his life, so I arranged ahead of time to have it taped. In retrospect, I believe that night in 1955, the seed for the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change was planted in my mind. What happened in Montgomery would eventually become a living model for future generations through an institution that would preserve and grow Martin's vision. I suppose I have always had a feel for history. It's a gift my mother had. Martin was too busy racing around, preaching, and being at the forefront to record his efforts. I remember telling myself, that the life Martin and I were living was important, and that just maybe people might someday want to know what was said and done. I knew I could not depend upon most of the mainstream press to record these events accurately. I often agonized over the ways they mangled the truth. So beginning with Martin's first mass address, which officially launched the Montgomery bus boycott, I started saving his speeches, his papers, and all other memorabilia. Of course, this makes sense in retrospect, but back then I thought that if we who are living these events don't document our story, whom could we depend upon to be the truth-tellers, to pass on accurate information to the next generation? Who would teach them, motivate them? Would the next generation understand what we were doing when we ourselves were young people if we didn't pass on our story? Of course, that night, December 5th, 1955, I envisioned passing our story to the next generation as something Martin and I would work on together. And, of course, on that night, victory was far away. The struggle was just beginning. Yet we could see that black people were being empowered. A change had come. We were willing to walk the streets in dignity rather than ride buses in shame. Despite mass jailings, bombing of homes and churches, firings and slander in the press, we would not cooperate with injustice. We kept on walking and walking and walking for 381 days. On January 20th, 1956, Montgomery city leaders announced a Get Tough policy in a desperate attempt to stop the boycott. Get Tough amounted to a series of trumped-up charges for imaginary traffic violations intended to put fear in the hearts of the protesters. Martin was among the first to go to jail that day. The whole episode started when my husband and Robert, Bob Williams, Martin's former schoolmate at Morehouse College, who was teaching music at Alabama State College, drove downtown to pick up Mrs. Lily Thomas, the church secretary of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. At the edge of the parking lot, a policeman stopped Martin and asked to see his license. As Martin was showing it, someone overheard another policeman say, "It's that damn King fellow." When Martin stopped to let his passengers out, a policeman pulled up and said, "Get out, King. You're under arrest for going 30 miles in a 25-mile zone." Martin told Williams to drive on and notify me. Meanwhile, after two policemen searched him from top to bottom, they put Martin in the back of the car and drove off. I was at church when one of the church sisters came running up to me. "Mrs. King, Mrs. King, they got him. They've arrested Dr. King. Please do something." My heart sank, and a sense of indescribable agony gripped me. I knew that Martin, who had to help others relinquish their fears, was struggling with his own personal fear of being alone in jail. This was the South, the cradle of the Confederacy, and the stomping grounds of the KKK. It was not unusual for a policeman also to be a Klansman. Martin and I knew that not every black person arrested made it home alive. Later, when Martin told me about this experience, he described the sense of panic he felt come over him when the police car appeared to be taking him in the opposite direction from the jail. "I thought the jail was in the downtown section, yet we were going in a different direction," he told me. "The more we rode, the farther we were from the center of town. Pretty soon we turned into a dark and dingy street that I had never seen before and headed over a desolate old bridge. By this time, I was convinced that they were carrying me to some faraway spot to dump me off. I began to wonder whether they were driving me out to some waiting mob, planning to use the excuse later on that they had been overpowered. I found myself trembling within and without. I asked God to give me the strength to endure whatever came." Yet the police drove on to the police station and ushered Martin into a dingy, smelly cell. A big iron door shut behind him. He later told me that, as it dawned on him that for the first time in his life he was behind bars, gusts of emotion swept through him like cold winds on an open prairie. For me, the hours that Martin was behind bars seemed like days. While he went to jail physically, I went to jail emotionally. Just as he and his imprisonment could not get out, I felt the same way, imprisoned outside, since I could not get in to be with him and share in his suffering. but there was no time for tears. Immediately, I helped get the word out. Later that afternoon, Martin was released on his own recognizance, apparently because as soon as word of his arrest spread, so many friends and well-wishers congregated at the jail that his jailers wanted to be rid of him. It seemed that virtually every black person in town had either come to the jail or was at one of five mass meetings being held around town to pray for him. When Martin was released, he spoke at each of those five meetings. It had been the aim of the authorities to discredit Martin. However, his followers saw his release as a direct answer to their prayers, a blessing that only made him more of a hero in their eyes. Later that night, when Martin and I were alone, I did not tell him of my deep pain, my feeling of utter helplessness during those hours when I couldn't hear from him. I never let on how deeply it hurt me to see him in the hands of people who meant him harm, or how, for the first time, I had to reflect on the possibility that he could be taken from me and our infant daughter. I agonized over how unbearable life would be without him. I did not share these feelings. Instead, I listened to his story and encouraged him. Later, when he told his account of the jailing, he said, "As usual, Coretta gave me the reassurance that can come only from one who is as close to you as your own heartbeat. These are words that I never stopped cherishing." Shortly after Martin was released from jail, however, the hate calls to our home increased, keeping me awake and turning me into an insomniac. The threats and the prevalent danger depressed us both. One night at a mass meeting, Martin found himself saying, "If one day you find me sprawled and dead, I do not want you to retaliate with a single act of violence. I urge you to continue protesting with the same dignity and discipline you have shown so far." On another day, Martin came home feeling very weary. He looked at me and the baby and worried aloud that we might be taken from each other at any time. In the middle of the night, an angry phone caller warned, "Nigger, we've taken all we want from you. Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to Montgomery." One Saturday, I received 40 abusive and threatening calls. I admit I did not always respond with a non-violent demeanor. One of the early morning hecklers chided me for taking the phone off the hook. "It's my phone, and I'll do what I like with it," I answered angrily. In the background, Martin prompted, "Oh, darling, don't talk like that. Be nice. Be kind." The phone harassment became so heated that Martin told his congregation, "If you call and you cannot get through, it is because we take the phone off the hook at night. It's the only way we can get any rest." One night after I had fallen asleep, Martin answered another angry call. Later, he told me that at that moment it seemed he just couldn't take anymore. He slipped out of bed to make himself some coffee, but something stopped him in his tracks. He sat down at the kitchen table, put his head in his hands, and bowed his head. He began to pray aloud. "Dear God, I am taking a stand for what I believe is right. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone." At that moment, when he could go no further on his own power, Martin felt a sudden dramatic shift. He told me, "I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced it before. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, 'Stand up for righteousness, stand up for truth, and God will be at your side forever.'" That voice was right, because eventually, of course, we won. On November 13, 1956, the Supreme Court declared Alabama's state and local laws requiring segregation on buses unconstitutional. This was a landmark verdict. While the court's decision and its long-standing merits now take up volumes in law libraries, a more difficult story to tell is the effect on the human spirit, which will last even longer. On December 20th, the bus integration order finally reached Montgomery. After 381 days of determined protest, we could once again ride city buses. And for the first time since almost anyone could remember, we could sit where we wanted to and ride with dignity. The next morning, Martin became one of the first passengers to ride the desegregated buses. Rosa Parks, Ralph Abernathy, E.D. Nixon, and the Reverend Glenn Smiley, who was white, of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, all joined him, gathering in my living room beforehand in preparation to take their place in history. Right on time, at 5:55 a.m., the bus flashed its lights as it rolled up to the bus stop. How normal that looks today. On that day, though, its appearance was fraught with the dangers one might expect from taking off to be the first to land on the moon. As the lights from TV cameras flooded the bus, a smiling bus driver said, "I believe you are Dr. King." Martin said, "Yes, I am." "We're glad to have you with us this morning," the driver said. It's hard to describe the emotions. Exhilaration, pride, hope that washed over us all as we boarded that bus. Before 1956 came to a close, I was able to move from a supportive to a major role as a fundraiser for the Montgomery Improvement Association. Activists Bayard Rustin, Stan Levison, and Ella Baker founded a group called In Friendship, which raised funds for victims of economic reprisals in the South. They put on a big benefit concert at the Manhattan Center in New York City on December 5, 1956, to mark the first anniversary of the start of the Montgomery bus boycott. Ruth Bunch, wife of Ralph Bunch, who was the UN Undersecretary General for Special Political Affairs, and Minnie Wilkins, the wife of the NAACP's Roy Wilkins, were among the honorary chairs. I was the featured performer among the great stars such as Harry Belafonte and Duke Ellington, who performed that night at the jam-packed center. It was a frightening and humbling experience. First, I sang a program of classical music, and then I told the story of Montgomery. Weaving spirituals and freedom songs into the narration I had written, I spoke of the oppression suffered by many people throughout the ages, and said that God had always sent deliverers to them, as he had sent Moses to the children of Israel. "Today, God still speaks to the modern pharaohs to let my people go," I said. It was 1 year ago today, on December 5, 1955, that the cradle of political, economic, and social injustice began rocking slowly but surely. For a year, we have walked in dignity rather than ride in humiliation. As we walked to and from our jobs, we sang a song to give us moral support. Then I sang the spiritual. "Walk together, children, don't you get weary. Walk together, children, don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the promised land." I then told the story of Mother Pollard, an elderly lady we had met during the boycott, who said, "It used to be my soul was tired while my feet's rested. Now my feet's tired while my soul is rested." My next song was another spiritual, "Keep Your Hand on the Plow," of which I said, "We are going to keep our hands on the plow because we are determined that there shall be a new Montgomery, a new Southland, yes, a new America, where freedom, justice, and equality shall become a reality for every man, woman, and child. We have felt all along in our struggle that we have cosmic companionship, that God himself is on our side, and that truth and goodness ultimately will triumph. This is our faith, and by this faith we shall continue to live." At the close of the program, I sang one of Martin's favorite songs, the beautiful spiritual, "Honor, Honor." "Oh, run along, little children, to be baptized. Mighty pretty meeting by the water's side." Thus we had our songs, we had the spirit, and we had our unity, which only frustrated the racist extremists. But despite the fact that the violence continued, blacks were dragged off buses and beaten up, a pregnant woman was shot in the leg, a nonviolent Christian movement had begun. The paralysis resulting from hundreds of years of oppression had broken, We were learning to walk again as new human beings. The weapons of our movement, faith, love, prayer, action, and obedience to God, would prove mightier than bombs, dynamite, tradition, or the Ku Klux Klan. The boycott had become personal for me very quickly. It burned into my mind the price I might have to pay for refusing to bow down to a system that insisted upon reducing us to less than human. The knowledge that I could be killed, along with all the people I loved, had to settle within me. In addition, Martin was unfairly jailed for the first time, which made me understand that if we continued with the movement, I would have to adjust to his being snatched away from me without really knowing if he would ever return. Montgomery made me face the reality that I could lose my own life and leave my daughter without a mother. When you are in your 20s, even with danger all around, you have a sense of invincibility. But before the Montgomery experience ended, I knew what commitment was all about, and I knew just how far I would go with this new movement. Martin and I felt extremely blessed when we saw what was happening around us. At the beginning of the Montgomery experience, we had no idea that a local boycott would spread like wildfire until it was news worldwide. It was like a great revelation, a truth unfolding and exploding within us. Somehow we knew we had been divinely placed. It was God's will for us to be in Montgomery. I felt that we were part of a great drama unfolding on the stage of history. It was what I had been prepared for all my life, and a great sense of fulfillment came over me. I had a feeling that told me, we're supposed to be here. I have been called to be a part of this, and now I'm prepared to go all the way. If something happens to me, then let it be.
And that will do it for the second audio segment. We will pick up there next week. That will be chapter 6. We'll start at chapter 6. Context of White Supremacy. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, your line should be open. If you would like to participate, feel free. I'm trying to see if there's anybody that I missed completely. I think, is this Thomas in New York? I think we might have missed you totally. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary? Oh, this is not Thomas in New York. The caller at 6900. I think this is, you have not commented this evening. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Good evening, Gus, to all the callers. This is Jay from New York.
Greetings.
Greetings. Just wanted to follow up. I wasn't able to get in on the during the first section. One of the things, and I think you mentioned it earlier, in reference to the bombings and also the burning down of Coretta's dad's store, or was it the, I think it was the wood mill. One question that I had as I was reading the book, and I didn't see it, and I continued to read on to see if they mentioned it, and I'm pretty sure that non-whites didn't have insurance, you know, that they would be paid out for any of these bombings or any of these burnings, but just tons of black self-respect for continuing to kind of rebuild after these things continue, these terrorist acts continue to kind of be thrusted upon the family. So I just continue to look to see, because just thinking about that time frame and how is this strong black male just continuing to pick up and just kind of rebuild from scratch. I know they had to rent an apartment after the house was firebombed, but I'm just thinking about having to rebuild the store and kind of start up again. And I think it happened once again later on, but I'm not sure if anybody picked up on it and I missed it, but I have been kind of looking out for that. If there was anything that spoke to any type of insurance or any way that they were, you know, compensated for that. I'll mute my line. That was the only question that I had.
Mm, Good point. We'll pay attention to that as we go. I think everyone else was with us previously. I did want to get in. Retired firefighter was correct. From Melba, Patilla Beals, Warriors Don't Cry. She was one of the Little Rock Nine. They integrated the schools right around this same time period, 1957. I'm pretty sure that's going to be mentioned probably next week. We'll see. She writes, the experience of walking down the hall to my homeroom each morning got so worrisome that I doubled my repetitions of the Lord's Prayer as I walked from the front door up the stairs. Inside the homeroom class, I was entertained by a whole new series of indignities. I arrived one day to find a doll that resembled me with a rope around her neck hanging from the door frame. Another time, someone had provided genuine urine to spray in my seat and on my clothing. Also, an interesting tidbit, at least it was interesting to me, that word dignity keeps coming up. The word dignity is in this book 23 times. For context, the word racism is in this book 19 times. I thought that was an error at first, but I'll say it again just because I thought it was interesting. Dignity is in this book 23 times. Racism is in this book 19 times. Other folks who have commentary, lines should be open. Feel free. Everybody can get about 5 minutes.
Can I be heard again?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I just reminded myself at the very beginning of the program, you were giving some historical facts, like the evening that Dr. King was murdered. I think you said, I could be wrong, I think you said 1969. And knowing that you are a historian, I'm pretty sure you know it was 1968 instead of 1969. I just thought about that. But anyway, to the second reading, I found it interesting that black people had to do most of the legal work in Brown versus Board of Education. Matter of fact, the lead attorney, I forgot his name, literally worked himself to death. He literally worked himself into a heart attack. Because he worked so hard with this, and even after the fact, and the Montgomery busing incident was an example of it, that black people had to risk their lives and do most of the challenging part of the legal activity that was going on. Including Little Rock and so on and so forth. You know, there's plenty of examples of it in history. And it just goes to show you on how functioning white people were and still are today, to whereas they are very much aware of what they're doing, and they allow non-white people. And I'm putting on point the white people who claim that they are not racist, and they allow this to take place, where all of these black people are being harmed or being in harm's way, and they are getting harmed. I might need to skip this part because I was about to mention about how black ministers at a point in time did not agree with what Dr. King was doing. So I'll just skip that until it presents itself. If it presents itself, I'm pretty sure it will in the book. I have here in my notes also, Mrs. Park's case was picked also because instead of the young lady who it was mentioned in this past reading, while her situation wasn't picked, is because of the lifestyle that Mrs. Park lived by, as opposed to, I believe, the young ladies. She has some other situations, and it's a similar strategy that white people do today with a black person that gets arrested. They'll go after their quote unquote criminal record and all sorts of things to deviate from what actually took place. And even during that time, the strategy was back then. And so Mrs. Park's case was the more easier situation to rally behind, so to speak. I remember Mrs. King and her this past reading was talking about.
It there, just to make sure we get everybody in, because there are a lot of callers. Appreciate it, retired firefighter. Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
No, but
We'll get Roz because he got cut right at the end of the first audio segment.
Thanks for allowing me to speak again, Gus. On what I was going to say at the last reading was when animals, and I've been studying animals since I was a very young child, and I'm now 43, but when animals urinate on their own kind, it is an act of dominance. And I just believe that white people are very bestial, and they live just like animals, and that's why they tend to throw urine and feces on black people like they do. It's a way of them asserting their dominance, no different than a dog or some other animal would urinate on an animal that it had no respect for. And also, in reference to getting a deeper understanding of what Christianity was meant to be to and do to black people, I implore everyone that can hear me to look up on Google King Leopold's letter to his missionaries. It was written in 1883, and I call it the true and living Willie Lynch letter. And it specifically focuses on what religion was supposed to do to the mentality and the brain computer of black people. To get into the text, she wrote on page 59, there had been other women arrested before Mrs. Parks. For example, in March 1955, 15-year-old Claudette Colvin refused to give up her seat to a white passenger. The enraged driver called a policeman. Several showed up, and the officers ordered Colvin to get up. When she refused, they dragged her kicking and screaming hysterically off the bus, and she was carted off to jail, where she was charged with misconduct and resisting arrest. Her case was widely discussed in black circles. At that time, Martin served on a committee that protested to the city and bus company officials. The committee was received politely, but nothing happened. I found that to be a great example of what refined racism, white supremacy looks like. They'll receive you politely. They won't call you nigger, but they won't do a darn thing for you. And that's why that stood out to me. On page 62, she wrote, "One of our first challenges was determining how to reach the 50,000 black people in Montgomery, a problem that, much to our delight, was solved by one of the biggest enemies of our efforts, the white press. A white woman found one of four leaflets which her maid had left in the kitchen. The enraged woman telephoned the local press to expose what her servant was up to, and their coverage spread the word better than we ever could have." Again, white women, the danger of white women, and how she was running to tell on her nigger, and just by doing so, she helped the movement that she was trying to stamp out. But it just goes to show, like Gus said previously about the white female, this is what white women do. Don't sleep on white women. Don't sleep on them. Don't sleep with them. On the following page, she wrote, Martin, come quickly. I called. He ran in and stood beside me, taking my hand, his face lighting up with excitement. Not one person was on the bus. Then came the next bus. It, too, was empty. This was the most traveled line in the city. We were so happy that we could hardly find the words to express our joy. Everywhere in the city that day, the scenarios were the same. Sidewalks crowded with men and women trudging to work, students at Alabama State College, walking or hitchhiking. People clustered in taxis. Some even rode mules. Others were in horse-drawn buggies, and a few were on bikes. Some people had to make treks as long as 12 miles that day. Never before had I seen such courage and unity in so many. From butlers to school teachers, from maids to the ministers, truly, as Martin said, a miracle had taken place. Instead of the 60% cooperation we had hoped for, we reached nearly 100%. I think that this is a great example of what United Independent looks like. I think it's a great example of what black people can accomplish when they have the same goal, regardless of what their feelings are about that goal. And also, instead of it being 381 days, it should have been permanent. And I think that's the best thing that we can do is nonviolent non-participation. I will stop there because I know Gus is probably about to stop me, but I had so much more to say. Maybe I'll be able to chime in with some of it next week. Thanks again, Gus, and I'll mute my line.
Awesome. Other folks who have commentary who would like to share, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't give my name last time. This is Jerry, Chattanooga, Tennessee. Once again, I don't have the book, but listening to it, it is very, very detailed for one, but there's a few details missing. I'm not sure if I missed it on the last week's read, but I was continuously waiting to hear about the firepower that Dr. Martin Luther King had all around himself and at his home when he was getting any threatening phone calls. And also, I was listening for the Deacons of Defense, and I didn't hear that. And I think that was one of the biggest takeaways that I got from tonight's reading, is that they wasn't putting the emphasis on that, because even though after he decided that he was going to be true to what he was saying, being nonviolent, and he got rid of those guns that he had, because he had a lot, for those of you who don't know, after he put those up, the Deacons of Defense stepped up and wouldn't let him go anywhere without being armed. So when we talking about all of these things, I thought that would have been a very important part of the story, and I just didn't hear it. So that was the biggest takeaway that I got from the reading tonight. And I would like, that's another question that I would like to pose to you and the other listeners tonight. What did they think about that, and if they thought about it at all?
Good question. We'll nab other listeners as we go. My quick thought would be, number one, I think that's a great point. Some of that is in this nonviolent stuff will get you killed, where we had Mr. Cobb on the program, who was a member of SNCC, contemporary of a lot of these folks. And he talks about a lot of that in detail, numerous black people who supported Dr. King and their movement, but they were armed, even if, you know, people were saying, come and be nonviolent. Fine and dandy, but I'm still going to have my gun as we go about doing this, even if you say you're nonviolent. That's all good. And there's a lot of that, and we've had many of those folks. Even we had one of the authors who's written specifically about the Deacons of Defense on the program in 2010 as well. We'll post both of those links. Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
To answer the previous caller's question, I did not think about that, and I don't think that I'm actually very well informed about that at all, about him having an arsenal of guns or anything like that. So thank you for bringing that up. I would like to reiterate a comment also on that. I think this, when I'm stepping back and just looking at the whole story, I think white people are extremely intelligent, and in that they know this is what a particular form of Christianity does to black people, that it makes it so it's really difficult to look at being, quote-unquote, I don't even think, it's not even being violent. It's just, that's a form of justice, too. Just being logical, being protective, being just human and saying that you want to defend yourself and not be terrorized this way. So I think that white people are extremely masterful in that, and that this is just kind of an evolution of that, like what happens to black people once they have some education or begin to make certain quote-unquote movements, that this is just what that kind of looks like, because it's littering everything that she's saying. And I think that it makes us illogical. Like, I hear a lot of things that just are incongruous, like they're not necessarily making that much sense, and I think the technical term for that might be cognitive dissonance. Like Gus was saying earlier, wait, is this the same person? Because before you talked about the house being burned down, your great uncle being lynched, and now it's like good white people and white boyfriend and stuff like that. And I think that's what happens when we come in contact with them, that like when we are isolated and we can just be, you know, black and do our thing, then when you come in contact with them and then all the things that you might originally feel, you're told are incorrect or that's not really envisioning a better world or anything like that, that you begin to think, you know, maybe there are some good white people, and then you see someone and there's a white person that does something nice for you, so then that means you can't blanket them and all that kind of stuff. And then I also was thinking about Reconstruction, because when the bus boycott is supposed to make things, quote unquote, equal, that we can ride the bus and be treated just as, quote unquote, fairly as white people are being treated on the bus. And after emancipation, there was a period that was supposed to be called, that's been called Reconstruction, which is where all of these things were supposed to happen, where we would just be made to be, quote unquote, equal and have, you know, our 40 acres and a mule, and we'll go ahead and we ended slavery. This is what we're going to do. And that did not work. Well, whites were not getting with that program. And so I wondered, did white people get together? Because white people, sometimes I underestimate white people's planning power. We're like, well, look, well, we can't, white people can't tell white people what to do, because then the white people are not going to rock with these white people. So maybe we need, you know, black people who can kind of, we'll use them like pawns. The ultimate agenda is we need black people to still stay second class. But if we subjugate them so much, they're going to retaliate physically. There's too many of them. They'll kill a lot of us, and we don't really want to lose that amount of number because we're so small. So we need to make it look like there are black people who are really pushing this, and that we, other white people, our hands are tied. We got to do something, and then we can kind of do, like, reconstruction a little bit. Because I think there's, when I listen to the story, I hear that white people are extremely involved in this. Even though she's not pinpointing a bunch of white people, there have been a couple that I'm like, white people have had a real big part of this. And so I was just thinking about that, that white people are definitely psychologically shaping us and making it so that they're always in these so-called movements. But with that, I'm complete. So thanks for listening.
Other folks who have a hand up have commentary they wanted to share. Do we miss anybody? Everybody who dialed in with a hand up is satisfied? I assume folks are good. The urine challenge is still there. Folks remember any other book club moments because there are a couple others. So some of the commentary that I wrote down from this week. Black babies cost less. The bus incident where the bus driver deliberately lurched the bus forward to throw the black babies from the seat to the floor. Just that. So just imagine that's happening, that sort of thing every day. I even remember Mr. Fuller said that the bus driver used to carry a gun on his hip. So if you sassed off or did anything, you know, hey, he could shoot you dead on the spot. The bus driver was like, you know, the police officer modern day in his era. The next one. In 1952, an intoxicated black man argued with a bus driver over whether he had put a dime into the slot. And they just continue what the police called, and he is shot and killed. Justifiable homicide. Dr. Welsing has a whole chapter on that. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Joanne Gibson Robinson, she is in... Eyes on the Prize. If you check out the documentary, a lot of video segments. She did a lot of gargantuan work. Julian Bond, Cowbell, when I took his class, he made us read quite a bit about her tireless dedication to fighting against racism, white supremacy. I thought it struck me when they compared what black people were doing in Montgomery, boycotting the racist white supremacist bus practices, compared it with the White Citizens Council, this white terrorist organization, and Dr. King agonized over that. Like, that kind of reminds me of people get riled up and compare, like, Black Lives Matter to racist or the Klan or what have you. Like, that's not anything that we should get anxious over. You know, I think some of that just comes down to fundamentals about, you know, what is racism, white supremacy? Because you're comparing me to these racist organizations. So what is racism, white supremacy, and am I doing that? Obviously not. If we're just saying we're not going to ride the bus, like I'm not even capable of being a racist. Just having, you know, fundamental understanding of what it is we're doing and not being concerned about white folks' feelings. Next, let's see. I thought it was brilliant. Black self-respect, Mrs. King, when she said she began saving her husband's speeches and writings and what have you, and realizing the significance. I think that's something that is hugely important. I think that's a part of black self-respect. If you're doing constructive things, you should be saving that. Like Mr. Fuller even has that in the code book where he talks about education.
where I've heard him describe it, where he says that's one of the things that happens in racism, white supremacy, where you collect information, you collect data, and it gets lost. They keep us on the move. We're not able to, you know, get stable and to store things. That's what white, they get to store information and use it so that their children and their great-grandchildren can use it to control their niggers. And we have to always start from scratch, as they say. But I thought that was brilliant. The section, let's see, next where she says... man, when she describes Dr. King's experience being in that police car in Alabama in the 1950s, and they seem like they were driving away from the police station, that at least is one scene where I will make sure anytime where I feel, you know, dignified enough to talk about Dr. King and I don't agree with him and, you know, he was a coward and all that Christianity and loving white people, I will remember this and, you know, have a sit down, because even with all that, you still might have some days that, you know, will test, you know, how tough you are to even go out and do what he did, whether you agree with it or not. He had a very difficult time trying to counter racism, white supremacy, and ultimately paid his life. Let's see. I really, really appreciate that Mrs. King did not say N-word, that she has what was said. Nigger, we've taken all we want from you. Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to Montgomery. That's what was said. I am so thrilled about that. Like, let's not sanitize. Let's just put it down, you know, what was done. I think that's the best way that we go about solving this problem, reveal truth. I thought it was interesting, or not interesting. I thought it was extremely important when she says that blacks were dragged off buses and beaten up. Pregnant women, a pregnant woman was shot in the leg around this busing issue. The total disregard for black life, black pregnant mother even being abused, and that, hear that sort of thing even now. I also thought it was interesting when she says the weapons of our movement, faith, love, prayer, action, and obedience to God. That just stuck out to me because it was significant enough that she didn't want that in her vows, like her, I guess, the connotations about obedience and her vows. But then it came up again there, just stood out, just that word now has significance in the text. And the last thing, this is important. It goes back to the same point that I mentioned before. I think Emmy, I think she said it as cognitive dissonance, you know, in terms of Mrs. King and processing this. But she says, Montgomery made me face the reality that I could lose my own life and leave my daughter without a mother. Again, your house was bombed. Your father's sawmill was burned down. She said her great uncle was lynched. Why would this be like, or I mean, it just, I see this regularly. I said, this to me reminds me when we were studying Hurricane Katrina, and it was a black male who was shot by a race soldier after Hurricane Katrina. And he said, people came by and were telling him, white people are shooting. White people are shooting. Be careful. And they just ignored it. They didn't pay any mind at all. And they continued. And they got shot by a white person, almost killed. And he said it just didn't. Something about the system of racism, white supremacy causes damage where we just are not able to accurately grasp and apply, even when we're having it direct, being terrorized directly, where we're just not able to grasp that and, you know, really accept. This is what it means to be white. This is what racism, white supremacy is. This is the reality. To just accept that and work to try to solve that problem. It seems like there's just a tremendous tendency to minimize and to not be accurate, honest about that. Major problem, in my opinion, unless I'm misunderstanding. We have about 3 minutes. Did anybody have any other commentary, questions they wanted to respond to? Other books where the urine comes up, 3 minutes.
Can I be very sure. Quick?
Emmy, proceed.
Just really quick. I was wondering, is it possible, like, to think about it being as maybe learned hopelessness or helplessness, and maybe the repeated trauma has, like, adjusted our ability to actually respond or register, like, white people? I wonder. I don't know if there's been any research on that, but that would be really interesting. Like, maybe if you do it for so long, like, at some real subconscious level, we've been associated not being able to actually do something if it's white people. I don't know. That's a question if people, you know, I was just curious. All right, thanks.
Retired firefighter?
although Dr. King persisted with a quote-unquote nonviolent strategy, violence from white people had to exist. There was one time where even he admitted that he was not successful. I think it was in the state of Tennessee, to whereas the police chief was very courteous and nice in his mistreatment, and they had to leave the city. So I thought that was pretty interesting as far as his nonviolent strategy. Violence had to exist in order for it to work.
Right on. Anybody else? We have about 90 seconds. Yeah. Roz?
Yes. This is interesting. On page 69, it says their vote was right because eventually, of course, we won. On November 13, 1956, the Supreme Court declared Alabama state and local laws requiring segregation on buses unconstitutional. This was a landmark verdict. While the court decision and its longstanding merits now take up volumes in law libraries, a more difficult story to tell is the effect on the human spirit, which will last even longer. I just found it interesting that it was a landmark verdict for you to be treated like a human being. That's all. Thank you.
From Chris Kyle, American Sniper. People were with us for the book club and we read that back in 2014-2015. He says, so this is during the Navy SEAL training. What I couldn't stand was being cold, lying out on the beach in the surf, stripped down, freezing my ass off. That was the worst. I'd lock my arms with the guys on either side of me and jackhammer my body, vibrating crazily with the chills. I prayed for someone to pee on me. Everybody did, I'm sure. Urine was about the only warm thing available at that point. If you happen to look out on the surf during a buds class and see a bunch of guys huddled together, it's because someone out there is pissing and everybody is taking advantage of it. Urine also pops up in Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It, the father of Venus and Serena Williams. He talks about his involvement in the civil rights movement. This is a little bit ahead of where things are with Mrs. King's autobiography. But Richard Williams writes, I decided to postpone heading west and go instead to Mississippi. I knew a man who was working on civil rights projects there, and I wanted to join him. A series of freights led me to my friend, and I joined his group working to register blacks to vote. Every day we faced threats and acts of violence. When a group of us went into a black neighborhood to work to talk to people about voting, a small crowd of whites intercepted us. They had bats, bottles, sticks, and bricks, and kept calling us niggers. I remember kneeling and praying to God for strength to get us out of there. While I was kneeling, a white boy pulled out his penis to urinate on me. I carried a homemade zip gun in my pocket. As I pulled the gun out of my pocket, one of our youth leaders rushed to my side and told me to put the gun away. I said, through gritted teeth, I'll shoot him if he pisses on me. Fortunately, we were able to escape without injury, but I was asked to leave because I promoted violence. I knew it was true. I could not embrace a turn-the-other-cheek philosophy. I wasn't running anymore. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was my motto, and I insisted on living by it. I could not and would not be a victim again, not of my own free will. King and Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael and other leaders of the civil rights movement had brought a new way of walking. I remember hearing myself read this because I narrated this book. If you go back in the archives, one of him, this is also a book that threatened my top 10. Very, very good. And all about racism. This passage is pretty indicative of the whole book and its content. But urine, very, 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 very common in the system of racism, white supremacy. You can come to your own determination about what that means. With that, that is our 3 hours. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll be good to hear a review of the past week's events and counter-racist suggestion. Thanks all for tuning in for the book club. Amazing book. Thanks again to the New Orleans Tribune because they did an outstanding review of the book and said this is phenomenal, and it seems thus far that they were correct. We'll pick up next week on Chapter 6. If you have a commentary that you want to write in, untiljustice@gmail.com, we'll have a few weeks to go so we can read as we go. With that, I will state again, as you heard in the text,
being intoxicated certainly is not going to put you in a position to be more efficient countering racism. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. I think Dr. Welsing, I think Mrs. Coretta Scott King, I think her husband, Dr. King, would all encourage us. Let's stay sober. We do not need any cigarettes, alcohol, cannabis, any other narcotics to solve this problem. Let's take excellent care of ourselves and see if our sober brain computers can crank out some solutions, concepts to get this problem solved immediately. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in, and special thoughts, prayers to Pam, Trojan Horse Publications. We are thinking of her and her family at a time of loss. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.